also there's a submission from the Public Service Accountability Monitor. The presenters are not here. However, there's a documentation that was circulated for all members. So I think it will be appreciated if members can go through the submission. And as a norm, the committee will obviously summarize what are the issues that are raised there. And there was another one which I think, of course, it's a bit not relevant for the discussion, particularly also that, yeah, it doesn't say anything, just one page. And at this stage, I think we'll welcome the chairperson of the standing committee, Honorable Khosa. She's here, and thanks very much, Chair. All the relevant participants of this meeting are here, honorable members. I do not know whether there is any apology today, just to start with the formalities. Can I be advised? Okay. Thanks, Andy.
Good morning, chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. From the Standing Committee on Appropriations, we have four apologies, one from Honorable Sheikh Imam, one from Honorable Sik, Honorable Madlopa, and Honorable Ndongeni.
Okay, those are, okay, yes, Zoran.
Morning, members. For the Select Committee on Appropriations, there are no apologies. Thanks.
Well, those who are not here, then shall be regarded as absent, if, because you'd expect that all members would be here. No apologies, absent without apology. And, okay, honorable members, I think we know Honorable Isaac just indicated that he's picking some of the documentation from office. So I think it's in order if we can proceed with our meeting. Honorable Chair, if you have some remarks to make, you welcome to do so. Yes.
Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Let me also greet our guests, the media, and yes, everybody who is here. Thank you so much for making time just to come and engage with us. We know that you had a lot of other things to do, but then you then also this morning, we appreciate the fact that you prioritized us. Obviously, we had to meet here this morning. Meeting to receive submissions from various stakeholders, submissions that will assist the committee when we consider both the finance bill and also the 2016 adjustment bill. I think this will help us, and also it helps us big time in terms of meeting this other requirement, which is part and parcel of our core business, which is public participation. Thank you so much. Without you, we're not going to be able to meet this requirement, and it is a constitutional requirement which we had to meet before finalizing the budget process, the midterm budget processes. Thank you so much. We are looking forward to having serious engagement, vigorous engagement with our own selves. And what is important is that indeed with the time that we have now, we at least make sure that we make meaningful and constructive engagement. Thank you very much. You are all welcome. This is our meeting.
Thanks, Chair, for the remarks. Then let's invite Khosatu. We have Matthew Park, our Khosatu Parliamentary Coordinator, here to present. Obviously, we'll speak broadly and specifically on the areas that Khosatu deems relevant in what was tabled by the Minister broad policy statement. So, Matthew, most welcome. Can you start the presentation? Thanks.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairs, and good morning, members, and comrades and colleagues. Thanks just for giving us a chance to raise our two cents of thoughts on the budget, on the medium-term budget. We hope it will assist the committee in its deliberations. But yeah, the viewpoints which are represented from COSATU and its affiliates and its members. I want to give an apology before Chair, before I start, because some members have had this thing many times before. And I look at Honourable De Beer and Mandy and others. I might sound like a broken record player, but we know governance issues take time to change, so we're optimistic that we will convince government on certain issues. And I think Chair also said some of our issues might overlap between the revenue side of the budget statement, the appropriation side, the expenditure side. It's always a bit difficult to neatly divorce them from each other, as they're all kind of interlinked, but nonetheless we hope it will assist the honourable members with the important work. Yeah, and I think Chair must also appreciate members coming on Friday morning. We know it's difficult for members from Pumalanga and other provinces who must catch flights. There are not many flights a day to those provinces from Cape Town. So yeah, let me start, Chair. I'll try to be to the point. I think, Chair, because COSATU, we do appreciate government in a very difficult financial space. We can't just come up with pure slogans. We know budgetary-wise, government is under extreme pressure. We have to manage our debt levels appropriately. But I think we also appreciate government is battling with the issue of how to create jobs, and that we're essentially in a difficult cycle of kind of jobless growth all the time. I think, Chair, we also appreciate that government is having to balance between how much tax one can take and what's the appropriate level and so on. So for us, we know government is in a very difficult space. We thought some parts of the budget are positive, but other parts of the budget we were a bit concerned around. I think for COSATU, our number one concern is always about job creation. And our feeling that if we can't address the issue of one out of three workers being unemployed long term, all the good work that we do across the board won't make a difference. It'll be affected or collapse if we don't address those issues. So our key frustration is that we don't really get a sense from government how are we going to break this monster of 36% long term unemployment. We don't think it should just be a challenge for the Department of Trade, Industry or Economic Development, but really issue a marching order for all departments, all provinces, all municipalities. So that really is our key frustration, Chair. Chair, look, I think we do appreciate that this isn't a full austerity budget. Most of the departmental allocations and allocations to provinces and municipalities have kept in line with inflation, and also in key delivery areas there's above inflation increases. I think for ourselves as COSATU, we would support the approach of the US or China where you stimulate economic growth through expenditure, obviously within manageable reason. We're not really convinced by the EU approach, which is to slash expenditure, and then the result has been stagnant economic growth. I think having said that, we appreciate the commitment of government to spend almost 900 billion rand over the next few years on infrastructure expenditure. We think that's a positive effort. I think we also appreciate that social expenditure, the social grants have as small as they are, but they have had seen increases. And that's a very important lifeline to millions of South Africans. Chair, I think that on the public service vacancies, some of the issues we had warned previously about, we are starting to see the problems materialize. That we understand government has to control expenditure and it can't be an out-of-control wage bill, but we've seen already from our affiliates and the departments and provinces some of the negative impacts around freezing the vacancies. In the Eastern Cape, our teachers' union has been forced to take the education department to court because of about 1,660 teachers who haven't been paid. In Limpopo, we saw about 550 doctors' posts being frozen. I know in Mpumalanga, there was a problem of about 1,400 teachers' posts being cancelled, but I believe that the premier of that province intervened to resolve that issue. So I think just to highlight some of the difficulty that we can freeze posts, but it shouldn't be at a service delivery level. We think that we can rather freeze posts at a senior management level, and there's other ways you can freeze posts. But I think, Chair, I'll plead on that issue that let those departments go to the Public Service Bargaining Council. I think they'll find the unions well-placed to offer insight and suggestions on how to manage this in a appropriate way. We know that the Minister of Finance, Comrade Gordon, made a commitment around selling state assets. We know that's not a new thing, but I think we want to understand what assets does government want to sell. We're a bit concerned about stripping the family silver, so to speak. Chair, I think we do appreciate government's efforts to manage the debt levels in an appropriate way, especially to not get ourselves sucked into too much external debt. I think lastly, Chair, on this issue, as COSATU, we're not just throwing stones at government, we're also engaging with government and business and NEDLAC to address the issues of labour market stability, address the issue of strikes or strike violence. We have seen some positive engagements there, both on the labour market stability and also the minimum wage. And we are cautiously optimistic that by the State of the Nation address in February, the President will be able to present good news to the country on both issues. And we think that might also help to address our good friends in the rating agencies who are sitting on government's neck. Chair, I think in terms of revenue proposals, just basically two issues. I think one is our plea is not to increase tax levels, the tax burden on working class or middle class. We know that there's been a lot of noise in the public about increasing VAT, and it's a very kind of attractive thing to do for government because it generates a lot of money quickly. But our fear there is that it hits the working class the hardest, who don't have a choice about buying bread or electricity or transport. And it also can have a negative impact upon the economy. And our plea also there is about increasing income tax around the middle class like we had in the last 2 years. Again, you're squeezing people who are battling to meet month end. Our suggestion is that, that we think there is space to increase taxes around luxury goods, around non-essential imports, and around the wealthy, etc. Not in a reckless way, but in a reasonable way. Chair, just in terms of the issue of the public service vacancies, also in the wage bill, a lot of our unions are quite unhappy with this constant focus by government around public service wage bill. Most civil servants don't earn a huge salary. If you look at most civil servants, our teachers, our nurses, our police officers, earning about 240,000 rand a year. And there's been a constant harp by politicians, by government, that the wage bill is too high. Public servants are to blame, they're greedy. We find that it's a bit unfortunate because the increase in the public service wage bill chair is also as a result of a good intervention by government over the past, since 2009, to increase the service delivery posts in health and police and education and so on. And I think Chair also must acknowledge that government has had to address the parted wage gap since 1994 in the public service. But we do feel that in the top end of the public service, we can cut the fat there. We don't need to have pedestal CEOs earning 3, 7, 8, 10, 12 million rand. There's a lot of fat that one can cut there, Chair. Chair, I think we must appreciate the efforts by Treasury. I think as COSATU we can say that, around cutting some of the bling expenditure. We think there's been some good work there. There's been some excellent work around the Chief Procurement Officer in terms of reducing wasteful expenditure. I think we'd want to see that work kind of intensify and to expand. But I think, Chair, also we'd want to plead for the provinces and municipalities to also be brought on board, because it seems they're not all singing from the same page as national government on this issue. We have seen positive reductions in the expenditure on consultants and rollovers. But I think, Chair, the AG highlighted over the last month, the rise in wasteful expenditure is quite disappointing. Chair, yes, I think in terms of social grants, social development, I think we're pleased with the department kind of holding the fort around social grants. And I think we're also pleased that to Honourable De Beer that the government has released the social security discussion paper by hook and by crook. We got it out of them last week. The table has been left. We know it won't happen overnight. It might take a few years, but I think it's part of a useful discussion around overhauling social security in a progressive, sustainable way. So we're glad that it's helped, and we appreciate the Finance Committee's efforts in that regard. Chair, I think we are concerned about the issue of social workers, that we've seen social workers, community health workers not being paid at times. There was an article in today's New Age about community health workers in Gauteng not being paid or being underpaid. We've seen it in other provinces too. Chair, in terms of health, we strongly support government's plans around the NHI, but we're a bit frustrated about the slow progress in laying the foundation for it, and of course the continuing challenges in our public health facilities, and also around the vacancies there. Chair, we do support the Ministry of Health's efforts to deal with alcohol abuse, substance and tobacco abuse. And in fact, Chair, I think you've seen in the media over the last month a lot of noise around the proposed changes to alcohol from DTI. I think as COSATU we strongly support those things because if we look at the cost to society around alcohol and tobacco abuse, substance abuse, it's too massive. Most of our violent crimes is alcohol related. Most of our accidents on the road are alcohol related. So in fact they would want government to be more militant and to be harsher. Chair, I think we'd also want to appreciate the good work done by government over the past 8 years around increasing funding for tertiary education. I think most of us have forgotten the good work that's been done there. But I think, Chair, we'd also want to plead for government to heed the call of students to fast-track the realization of free education. We don't think we need to have endless commissions of inquiry. We just need a calculator, and let's find out how do we fund this appropriately, Chair. Chair, if we're looking at issues of the cutbacks, Chair, we also think we need to highlight the issue of the National Youth Development Agency. We're not sure if we're getting value for the money of 400 million rand, and if students are desperate for money, we think we need to have a discussion around the NYDA, as well as the CETA's functioning. Chair, we must really acknowledge the good work that DTI and Economic Development Departments have done around creating jobs, but I think, Chair, we'd want to see government actually allocating more money to those departments, especially to support fragile sectors like motor manufacturing, textiles, agriculture and tourism. I think that really should be the focus of government. Chair, in terms of the Department of Labour, our frustration here really is about the lack of resources being given to the department. There are far too few labour inspectors across the country to enforce labour law. It's really a tiny drop in the ocean. And in fact, we just want to see more money being allocated to that department. Chair, but I think we'd also want to caution, as we always do, to Treasury, not to get too excited by the UF so-called surplus. It's not really a surplus to a large extent. It's because that money has been invested in investments, because the UF has actually done a good turnaround. But I think, Chair, we'd want to see actually access to the UF being increased to address unemployed workers. But it shouldn't be shifted to other parts of the budget to plug other holes. Chair, in terms of COGT and Public Works, look, we appreciate government is in a very difficult spot around creating jobs, and it's been a 22-year frustration for government. We appreciate the ideas of the Community Works Program and the Expanded Public Works Program, because you're creating jobs for people who can't get a job because of low skills, etc. But we're quite worried, Chair, that this is becoming increasingly a source of cheap labour for provinces and for municipalities. The EPWP and Community Works Programs are meant to do once-off projects, but I find increasingly they're doing permanent municipal functions. So we know in rural municipalities who lack sufficient funding from national government, it's becoming a way of balancing the books, so to speak, because of a lack of a rate space. But even, Chair, even if you go to the most well-resourced municipality in the country, Cape Town, you find EPWP are now being used to clean municipal buildings. And surely the cleaning municipal buildings is a permanent function of a municipality. And that effect actually crowds out the small companies which actually tender to clean those municipal buildings, because they can't compete with the EPWP stipend. But you also find in Cape Town, not to pick on Cape Town too much, but at one stage the city police were using EPWP funding to employ people to raid gang houses. And for us, that's a huge problem because these are meant to be once-off projects, not permanent municipal functions. In other provinces, you find EPWP being used to build roads, repairs, drain water, install electricity. And sure, those are meant to be the permanent functions of government. But it seems now it's becoming a way of cheap labour to offset municipal funding crises. Chair, I think we also are suggesting as COSATU that there's a need to reconsider the role of district municipalities. We feel that we really have too many municipalities that are not affordable in most cases. And do we need to have both districts and local municipalities? Perhaps there's a need to merge the districts with the municipalities. Chair, I think in basic education we're heartened by the minister's efforts to address the mud schools, the pit latrine crisis, the textbook crisis. But we're worried that we're constantly shifting the goalposts or the deadline around it. I think the figures released last year by the department was that there's still about 400 schools without proper sanitation. And I think for us that's still a crisis. It can't be so difficult to put in toilets in schools. We did an excellent job around the World Cup. We can manage Kuberg nuclear power station, but we seem to have difficulty putting in toilets in a school in Limpopo. Chair, in terms of energy, again, I think as COSATU we appreciate the effort the government has done in turnaround around electricity in the last 2 years. So we haven't had blackouts, I think, it's 2 years now, if I'm correct. And that's a good achievement, and I think government should be commended for that. I think we'd also appreciate the rolling out of renewable energy and the increasing investment in the country. It's about 190 billion rand so far, and we've seen about 27,000 jobs created. So I think for us that's positive. But I think, Chair, we want to see government actually intensify the rollout of renewable energy. We think that you could actually pass a law to require all buildings in the country to have solar panels within 5 or 10 years, for example, just to lessen the electricity burden upon Eskom and to support renewable energy. And, Chair, that could also be a way of generating income for poor households. Chair, as COSATU, I must say we're deeply opposed to nuclear energy being expanded. We feel it's simply unaffordable. It's dangerous for health, it's dangerous for the environment, but also, Chair, it's all technology. Renewable energy is becoming increasingly cheaper and more efficient, and we think that's really, we must go that way in the future. Chair, I think we want to support government trying to get a hold of the expenditure levels in Durco. We think there is a lot of fat in that department which can be reduced, but I think we also want to see a stronger focus from Durco around promotion of trade. We can't just have embassies for the sake of cocktails, but it must be linked to trade promotion. Chair, in terms of public enterprises, look, I think we're all concerned about the endless bleeding in our three state-owned airlines, and even in SA Airlink, which is we have an equity share. Clearly, it's not sustainable to have 3.5 state-owned airlines. We need to have one. But our frustration, Chair, is how we're going about it. We see now that government has appointed Bain Capital from the US to do a study on the sustainability of our airlines. I'm not sure members know much about Bain Capital, but it's got a reputation in the US for basically gutting companies, retrenching workers, and then selling it for a profit, irrespective of the cost to workers. We think we can amalgamate the three airlines into one airline, but do it without job losses. And for example, Chair, we have now Mango advertising for a CEO. We don't think we need to have three CEOs. Rather, whilst the timing is on our side, start working together to save jobs, but to save a state-owned airline. I think, Chair, we do appreciate the turnaround in the post office over the past year. A year ago, postal workers were not getting paid on time or getting paid. But we're also worried about Telkom, which seems to achieve profits purely by retrenching workers all the time. About 20 years ago, Telkom had about 50,000 employees. Today, it's about 7,000, and they're planning to cut a few more thousand. But the very same Telkom will then outsource those work to the retrenched workers via labor brokers and so on, Chair. Chair, we know we love our politicians, we love our ministers, but we don't think we need to spend so much on protecting them with bodyguards. We think the VIP unit protection allocation in the budget, if we read it correctly, what we read is about 2.6 billion. I know Honorable Mania said previously it's about 6 billion rand, but whichever it is, we think we're spending too much on it. We're not saying politicians must be molested by criminals, but we need to get a reasonable balance, Chair. Chair, in terms of agriculture, we really think we need to have more support given to emerging farmers, but also to the sector as a whole. I think it's a very strategic economic sector. If we lose agriculture, we'll be in a big crisis as a nation. And somehow we expect them to compete without state support against the EU or the US, where agriculture is heavily subsidized. I think in the EU, each cow gets about $10 a day from the state. Yet our farmers here, emerging and existing farmers, are on their own. And I think we've seen half of the land restitution cases essentially failing because of a lack of systemic support. I think, Chair, also as COSATU, we want to really see government moving with speed around land reform and providing access to land equity to farm workers. Chair, in terms of transport, I think, to state the obvious, we're all deeply concerned about the governance crisis in PRASA. I think it's really a national crisis. I think more work needs to be done. And again, Chair, I think as COSATU, and I apologize if I sound like a broken record player, to raise e-tolls, but I think we'd want to declare e-tolls has died, and it's time to look at a different funding model for public transport in Gauteng. Chair, just coming towards the end, in terms of water sanitation, we really feel that this is the next ESCOM type of a crisis, that we're leaving this to municipalities too much. Municipalities don't have sufficient resources to maintain our water infrastructure or are not paying attention to it, until it blows into a crisis, and we've seen it across the area. I think, Chair, we're leaving our informal areas far behind around access to water and sanitation, simply because many of them are on private land, or on parastatal land, or are on uninhabitable land, and therefore we don't feel the need to deliver basic services there. Chair, in terms of housing, I think suggestion there that we must revisit the housing model and perhaps look at service plots. In conclusion, Chair, I think we appreciate the good parts of the budget. So we try to make some helpful suggestions around areas we think we can fix and so on. Chair, I think, our plea to government is to continue to look at how to reduce wasteful expenditure, not to harp too much on public service wage bill, but to engage the unions on how can we reduce costs. I think, Chair, plea also is around when you do tax reform, it must be progressive and not a burden upon the poor. And I think, Chair, lastly, that government's work must always be focused around creating unemployment. And I think also, Chair, just to emphasize our position around nuclear energy, around the water crisis. I think very lastly, Chair, that the President made a very progressive commitment in the January 8th statement in 2014 about moving away from outsourcing and labour broking in the public service. But yet, we actually have seen an increase in many departments in that regard. That's the conclusion, Chair. So my apologies if I've jumped across revenue, expenditure, appropriations, national provinces, but we hope that it assists the committee in its good work. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thanks very much, Matthew, for the presentation. As we indicated, you clearly stated that you will comment broadly on the MTVPS policy statement, and you have flagged quite a number of issues, and I think, obviously, it's a process that prepares for the main budget in the coming year. So, honourable members, these are specific issues. Of course, I would like if you could just in a bit share some experience relating to COSATU's option that favours China and US policy stance. Both countries are larger economies and they've got very strong industrial base, China leading in manufacturing, almost in the world leading in manufacturing. So South Africa, very small economy. Currently, the policy stance, of course, navigates on the thin line between retaining the current expenditure and as well as getting not to increase the debt levels that has plummeted so high. So we depend more on extractive of our minerals. So if China and US slow down, the economy shakes. So how really? What how? Because how really do we say the contrast? What is it that South Africa must do? I like you to elaborate a bit. That's interesting.
Sure. I'll just jump to your question, Honourable Chair. I think for us, Chair, that we support the stimulus-driven approach to economic regeneration. And I think we appreciate government since 2008 economic crisis has really tried to stimulate growth. I think, Chair, we've seen in the EU when they've cut expenditure, it's really generated 1% growth rates for them. And as you said, in China you have 7%. In the US, you have about 3.5%. But also in the US, you've seen as government has driven expenditure-led growth, they've created on average about 150 to 200,000 jobs a month. In fact, we've seen ourselves in the first two quarters of this year losing jobs. Chair, we know it sounds easier than it is to be done, but we can point to two areas we think government has been quite successful working with business and labor in the economy, the textile industry and the auto manufacturing industry. As you know, Chair, when we lifted tariffs too quickly in the late 90s in the textile industry, we lost about 100,000 jobs in that industry. But I think in the last 5 years, DTI, Economic Development Department, business, and the unions in that industry have worked very closely together to stabilize it and to grow. And in fact, in the last year, we saw jobs being created for the first time in the textile industry. That's really because of close collaboration between the sectors. In fact, Chair, I can even say that our clothing affiliate, SACTU, monitors government's tender database. Whenever they see any tender for textiles or clothing, They then phone the companies in that sector and say, please tender for this thing, because we're all in the same boat together. I think, Chair, also we can point to auto manufacturing and the steel industry, where governors work closely with business and the unions to say, how do we protect those fragile sectors? Can we use government to support them, protect them from imports, cheap imports, and to create jobs? We think we can expand it, especially into areas of agriculture, into other areas of manufacturing, to tourism, to see really how do we protect the issue. And I'll plead the chair also because that since the democratic breakthrough, government really adopted a kind of a laissez-faire approach to the economic sector. We didn't give sufficient support to our industries, and a lot of them then collapsed with a flood of cheap imports from China, from the EU, and so on. So we really think we need to see government providing support. We know we might find ourselves falling foul of your WTO regulations and so on, but our first priority must be to creating local jobs. Another example is around the pharmaceutical industry. We supported government creating a state pharmaceutical company, but I think more needs to be done to really see it getting off its feet, etc. So, I plead there is really to have a kind of a partnership, a tripartite partnership between the state, business, and the unions. How do we protect jobs? How do we grow the jobs? Maybe a last example, Chair, if we have a partnership, is we have a post office owned by the state which is struggling to survive. In fact, it can even be said it's on the verge of collapsing at times. But yet government is the biggest consumer of postal services. We have UNISA, so we think we need to really shift more resources to the post office. We know it's a difficult challenge, but again, if we work together, we think we can find each other, Chair.
Thanks very much, Matthew, for sharing with us COSATU's stance on a range of policy areas. So, members, it's meant for you. So this is meant for you to prove further. Whether COSATU's policy advice, this is what we, a democratic state, obviously open itself for thorough discussions, thoroughgoing discussions, and ensure that policy, but the budget is a reflection of policy objectives, really, that will change the lives of the people for the better. So COSATU is going to push on a range of issues this year. So let's discuss. Okay. You don't want to have a bite. COSATU is so correct that we really approve, take note of this submission. Okay, honorable members, in that order, honorable Shobe Sithole.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity to participate. I want to thank COSATU for their input. I just want COSATU to just enlighten me when they say free education, exactly what do they mean? And also give us examples of countries which have got free education and how they think we can actually fund it given our present economic situation.
Thanks very much, Honorable Sithole. Honorable Snugonyan.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Yeah, I think Honorable Shope has covered me in terms of free education, because I was going to ask in what form do you see this free education. But I also just want to note your revenue proposal and the fact that, you have touched on almost all these departments, and it's so difficult for one at this stage. I think one would need to really apply one's mind at a later stage. But in terms of the public service vacancies versus unemployment, I think all of us are in a state of, I don't know what, whether in a quandary or what, but the fact that the status of our economy and there's unemployment on the other side. The question would be, how do we move forward in this particular? Did you maybe apply your mind, maybe just to think of what you think perhaps we could do? Because I know it can't be easy for anybody. And then one thing that I just need a bit of clarity. I saw you, I didn't quite get what you were saying about the chief procurement officer and whether you are saying we must do away. I didn't really get it. And then with regarding the CWP and EPWP as cheap labor, as you've put it, I would agree to say, well, it is cheap labor because they get very little allowances. But my understanding is also that when this program was introduced, it was actually not meant to be for full employment. It was just a relief. These were relief programs for unemployed people. And experience has also taught us that when people are in this program, they don't want to get out. They don't want to get out because they are unemployed, and in many instances they demand to be employed full time. And yet when they are coming, maybe we are not telling them adequately that these are not permanent jobs, but maybe one gap that sometimes one identifies is that sometimes they get into the program, and I think one of the conditions was that they must get trained so that they are employable elsewhere. Perhaps then they are not adequately employed, but that would be a question that I would just have. Then the last thing, the issue of, you mentioned the issue of serviced plots. Are we looking at serviced plots to provide housing, or what are these serviced plots? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sinokonyane. On Chief Procurement Officer, I think COSATU acknowledges work in progress, the good work in terms of savings on the, what is it? Good work that is really pointing to, but we need to intensify that work. But Matthew is welcome to can comment further. Okay, Honorable Sir.
I just wanted him to say something about not actually a university education, but public education, since that we come from a past, a apartheid past, where many black people are unskilled, and as a country we do need skills. Did COSATU apply its mind on what to do with the many men and women who are not at work, who are at home and can be trained? I just want you to say something about that.
Thank you very much. Yes, Chair.
Sir, thank you for your presentation and also for your participation. But I would like you to elaborate more on the UIF surplus. I know one of the things that we are doing as this committee, we're looking at where can we find resources so that they can be redirected to the essential programs that have to be implemented to bring a better life for all, but also to develop the economy. You see, you know, economic development. For now, I know we've got a budget allocation, total budget allocation to economic development being 4.5%. Now you can see, and all of us, all indicators are saying we have to grow the economy so that we can then enjoy the spin-offs in terms of job creation, job creation, reducing inequality and poverty. So what is your take on the use of the UIF surplus?
Thanks, Chair. Honorable Terblas? Oh, not okay, Honorable Kabal. Oh, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to ask COSATU if they have had in your experience, have you had a focus on sectors of the economy which could be stimulated to create jobs and grow the economy? I ask this question because normally we generalize and say mining, manufacturing, but perhaps we need a special focus on sectors that we think could easily and within a reasonable period of time respond to such stimulation. The second issue, Chairperson, is whether COSATU has any view with regard to the, for instance, the unemployed workers being the main focus of inclusive growth in terms of SMEs, growing the SME sector, worker cooperatives, and the informal sector, and what is it that we need to do in that area. Lastly, Chairperson, I noticed that in the presentation, not much is said about the ocean economy. My interest, for instance, would be to say, what does the ocean economy mean to the workers along our coastal lines? For instance, the fishing here in Cape Town, Eastern Cape, Kuga, and so on, and KZN, Durban, Richards Bay, etc., and so on. And how do we stimulate? Do we focus a lot better on that sector? Because it seems to me that that's an important area, but we are not saying what does it mean to communities around those areas, and the aquaculture part of it, where communities are next to big rivers that could really assist in the area.
Thanks, Honorable Kawaza. Matthew, I think I'm going to give you a chance to respond to the issues. I just want to check with you. PTI releases industrial policy action plans on annual basis. And I guess is to really focus the state on industries that requires dedicated attention. Have you on your own maybe just conducted a comprehensive research on the impact of this industrial policy action plan? It's a couple of years now that these action plans are released. Whether or not we yield in the desired impact, I agree with you on textile and automobile. Clearly there's been great work that you've done to protect this fragile industry and also to revive textile particular and protecting the automobile sector. But just the impact, whether COSATU has undertaken a study in dealing with the impact of these industrial policy action plans. Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay.
First, Honorable McPherson.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Just one comment I have. As far as I know, there have been court decisions that say that even on private land, the state is required to provide for water. Well, access to water is actually the wording. So, you know, it is still incumbent upon municipalities to put water or access to water into private properties where there are settlements on private land. So it still is there. So I think we need to just push that a bit and push the awareness of it and push that obligation onto municipalities and make them aware that it is their function, it is their mandate and their obligation. So I just wanted to make the comment. Thank you.
My apology earlier, Honorable McLaughlin, to pronounce the name incorrectly. Honorable Darblash.
Chairperson, thank you. I just want to ask through you for COSATU a question. There are, you know, obviously the Extended Public Works program, he touched on that, and yes, you know, obviously it's a very low salary, not permanent job, stuff like that. There is a school of thought saying that why isn't this also rolled out to the private sector? Obviously allowing, you know, more people to be employed. even if it's very low. And I just want to ask Matthew, what is Kusatu's stance on something like that? Is that something that they will support? You know, possibly that, you know, obviously it's going to stimulate the economy in a very small way, but, you know, maybe that will lead to more permanent jobs. This is just a question, sir. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Members, let's give Matthew an opportunity to respond to questions. And thanks, Ms.
Thanks very much to the chair and to the members for a very, very important question. It's always nice to stop chair to see a family of Mark Schulper chair. That's, I think, it's one of our unsung heroes that we don't remember enough, you know. And I think Kusatu would always want to claim, hoping we have some DNA from Mark Schulper, even though it was through Saktu 60 years ago. But I think what we're saying around free education, free education is a nice slogan. Obviously, there's no such thing as something being free in life. Somebody must pay the university lecturers or the cleaners or the textbooks. I think our position here that we agree with the students, and we're grateful for the students to basically forcing all of us to wake up as a society, that we've allowed this issue to kind of be neglected, so to speak, for a little bit too long. I think, Chair, honestly, that the position is that funding shouldn't be a burden or a barrier for middle-class or working-class families to accessing tertiary education. And then we include the TVET colleges as well, Chair, because I think all of us forget about the TVET colleges at times. So I think our position, Chair, is that we would support funding the tertiary education for working-class, for middle-class families, not for the rich. Obviously, we have to balance the books. We can't just say the children of billionaires, millionaires mustn't pay their must. But I think, Chair, I think for us, we see that we can fund it in a sustainable way, not in a collapsing the state way, through income tax, company tax, graduate tax, as well as the NSFAS and the company bursaries. I think, Chair, we also would support having loans for students. But again, it must be at a manageable rate, like NSFAS does try to do currently, that you won't pay interest whilst you're studying, and that the payment scheme is affordable, not to burden the students too much. So I think we can, through a variety of tax efforts, address that. I think, Chair, I think we must also say that the EFF did raise some interesting proposals about a month ago, if I can say that, Chair. Normally we fight with the EFF, but about using funding from pension funds in the stock market. So I think there's a variety of tools we can use which will spread the burden as much as possible so we don't overburden any particular sector, but they're all in it together. So I think, Chair, that's our basic position, but the rich must pay. It can't be. And I think we do appreciate the effort by government around the no fee increase this year for anybody who's earning below 600,000 as a family. Even that's still quite limited, because it basically means if your parents are teachers, both parents, you might not qualify for that, but it's a good effort. Though I must say, Chair, we were a bit disappointed earlier this week to see that Stellenbosch University is increasing their residence fees by 10% next year, which is above the 8% cap that the minister set earlier this year. Chair, I think in terms of also what Honorable Schopper was saying about skills development, it's a very important point, and our frustration there really is that the CETAs have many massive governance challenges. And you've seen at times the CETAs almost wasting money or not spending the money properly. I'm worried that if they continue to do that, one day they will lose that money. Government won't be able to resist the temptation to shift it to universities. Chair, part of our thinking is that we should rope in the technicons more on the CETA funding, because the technicons, at least like your CPUT, some other technicons, are well established, have good governance, and they could be engaged to provide those short courses that are earmarked by CETAs. Because obviously unemployed workers, or workers generally, can't afford to go to university. They don't have the time. They just need a short 6-week or 3-month artisan course. So I think that is part of our proposal there. And also that we have so many CETAs that the administrative costs end up multiplying. We have a lot of CEOs. They spend a lot of time putting their pictures in the newspapers. And really we think the government should intervene a bit more there around good governance issues. Chair, then in terms of the other questions around public service vacancies and unemployment. You know, in fact, that's exactly the issue we have raised, that it might sound nice to reduce the public service headcount, but it also means that you're then increasing the unemployment level simultaneously. So it is a problem. We are sympathetic that government can't also have unlimited public wage bill. It needs to be managed in a correct balance. And our plea there really is that for the departments to engage with the unions at the bargaining council. You might find the unions are well placed being on the shop floor, the hospital, the department, to say, look, here we can afford to freeze these vacancies. But what we find so far is the departments just engage in a simple top-down approach and just say we're cutting. And we think it's having a significant negative impact in departments like health, home affairs, education, etc. But Chair, no, you're correct, Chair, to say that we strongly support the Chief Procurement Officer. We think he's done fantastic work. In fact, we don't really see his powers being increased and to do more work. But I think, Chair, also, I think we'll support the ANC's recommendation that the AG must also be given binding powers upon the provinces and departments and municipalities. Because currently you find that departments and provinces simply ignoring the AG's findings. In terms of the EPWP and CWP, I mean, look, we agree with government because government is desperate to create jobs for these township aunties, so to speak, who won't get a job anywhere. They don't have the skills. There's no jobs available in rural villages. But our frustration, Chair, which is raised by some who are municipal workers, is that a lot of the rural municipalities don't get sufficient funding from the state. So to balance the books, they're now taking up no more permanent jobs and basically outsourcing it to EPWP so they can then free those vacancies or they can even cut. And so we're finding, because the agreement we had with government originally was that the EPWP is going to go off to once-off projects, not to permanent municipal work. So permanent municipal functions of cleaning the streets, repairing the roads, electricity, the stormwater, should be done by municipal workers. But we're finding now that it's being shifted to the EPWP. And what we've had from our engagements with the Public Works Department around training, there's very little training being done according to Public Works. Very little oversight around training. We know some projects you can't really train to dig a ditch, there's not much training there. But in terms of that commitment that you've raised around training, I've experienced there's very little training. The other difficulty we've experienced is that at times some of these EPWP contractors were paying the participants with food parcels. That has prevalence in KZN. We managed to engage the government to stop it. Other provinces, you find there's a prevalence of paying below the minimum wage set for EPWP. Provinces like Northwest, Free State, often happens here, the project manager, this is a chance to make a profit. And he takes that, pays the EPWP, until very little. What we're seeing around the service plot is that, again, we know government is desperate to create RDP houses. But the quality and the size of the plots available often is too small and too limited. And you find, for example, if you look at Cape Town, there's a place called Samora Michelle, where the city council in the 90s built thousands of houses, but you can't see those houses today because they've been drowned or swallowed up by the shacks. Because the RDP house is about the size of this place here. It's just one room. The toilet is here, the sink is here, the door is here. And there's no space, that the plot is so small that family can't build upon the house. It's too small. Whereas if you go to some of the rural areas, the plot is much bigger. So the space where the family, if the child gets a job, he can build upon the house. And the other issue, Chair, is the quality. And at times, that's why we've been raising the issue of maybe the state having a role around construction or so on. Because the quality of the house often is so bad. There's an RDP area in Cape Town called West Bank. But the houses are below the ground level, so when it rains, the house gets flooded. If you turn on the kettle, you can't turn on the light. You can only use the electricity only enough for one appliance at a time. So if you cook, you must cook in the dark. After you cook, you can watch the TV. You can't do simultaneously because it'll trip the electricity. There's a place in Witsand next to Atlantis on the west coast. They had RDP show houses to attract people. But RDP show houses had cracks in it before. No one had even moved into it, but there's cracks there. There's gaps between the wall and the ceiling, gaps between the door frame and the walls. And it's often just because private contractors, because they're maximizing profit, that's short circuited, and because the departments and municipalities are not on top of the game, these things happen. I think, Chair, I think the current Minister of Housing and the previous Minister of Housing have both highlighted how they've had to spend billions of rands repairing thousands of RDP houses. So that's what I was saying, Chair. You know, if you look at some places like Limpopo, Well, people have been given decent 500 meter square plots of land with basic services. It can be a better chance at times for them to have better quality houses which they can expand upon. Chair, in terms of the Honourable Posa's questions around UAF, look, I know it's a very sexy thing when you hear a headline that's 120 billion rand in the UAF surplus. So it gives an impression that that money is sitting cash in a desk drawer and we can just grab it and settle our deficit issue. But in reality, it's actually not that. It's actually invested in the stock market. It's only available in 2 years, 3 years, depending upon the maturation date. But also, Chair, it's a workers' contribution. It's a workers' insurance. It's not a normal budgetary tax. And it's designed to help unemployment. Part of the reason why there's a surplus is that previously you could access the UAF surplus if you resigned from your work. Then that was taken away, so hence it created a bit of a surplus. But we have had very positive engagements with the government, with the Department of Labour around it. This Parliament passed last week, Tuesday, the UAF Amendment Act, which is going to significantly increase access to the UAF in a very progressive, sustainable way. So, for example, Chair, the UAF benefits currently are for 8 months. That's going to increase to 12 months. Maternity benefits are going to increase from 54% of your salary to 66%. But also, if a mother has a miscarriage in the third trimester or a stillborn birth, she will access UAF maternity leave benefits. So there's quite a few progressive things that have been done there. So hoping that will take place January, February, when the President signs it into law, and that will see that surplus being reduced in a progressive, sustainable way. But Chair, we're also engaging with the Department of Labour at NEDLAC, and the UAF board has done the costing around, including paternity leave and adoption leave, as well as including the issue of resignations. So that surplus should be used in a progressive way, which should help vulnerable workers, but also we think, Chair, it will help push money into the economy to stimulate economic growth. I think lastly, Chair, on that issue, last 2 points. The UAF board, in fact, in 2008, during the economic crisis, actually used some of its money to help with job creation projects or to protect jobs. And they've also helped companies which are battling to sustain themselves and want to retrench workers. That the UAF will take care of those workers for a 3 month or a 6 month training period. They'll be covered by the UAF. And after that, the company then re-employs them in new positions. So that's worked quite well, Chair. But also, last on that point, Chair, that because government has now released the Social Security discussion paper, we've also said, look, we can include UAF discussions there as part of a holistic, comprehensive social security reform. Chair, I think in terms of Honourable Kobaza, if I get the synonym correct, around economic stimulus for key sectors, I think, Chair, we've seen really fantastic work around renewable energy, where in a few years we've seen about 190 billion rand pumped into the economy, especially in the very remote areas like Namaqualand, where the Honourable De Beer comes from. We've seen solar panel farms growing quickly, and we've seen the result of 27,000 jobs being created, and also assisting government with the electricity burden. I think other sectors we can highlight are the issue of fruit and vegetables, livestock, aquaculture, as you raised, especially your fish farms in your inland provinces. I think, Chair, also tourism and motor manufacturing. I think, Chair, I'm also glad the Honourable Member raised the issue of fishing. Like the Parliament had a hearing on the small fishing issue last week. And our plea there is because fishing is a depleting stock, that it should be prioritised towards fishing communities, the traditional fishing communities of the Eastern Cape, or the other two Cape provinces, KZN, and then to fishing companies. What we've seen, unfortunately, Chair, is that, and for those who are from Cape Town would know very well, that the fishing quota allocation system has been rife with corruption. That I, as an official, I will give a quota to someone in exchange for money. And you will see constantly in the newspaper, Chair, of stories of people from Gauteng, businessmen who don't need a fishing quota, getting quotas. But small-scale fishermen from St. Helena Bay or Lambert's Bay or from Transkei struggling to get access to it. So our plea there has been really to have an audit of it and to simply focus on fishing communities and companies. Chair, in terms of the unemployment focus, we agree 100%. And our plea, in fact, is that government really needs to have a Marshall Plan to deal with unemployment. Because we seem to leave it only to DTI or to EDD to sort it out. We don't really see all departments or all municipalities or provinces having a job creation target for each sector per month. Chair, in terms of your questions all about Chair, we've had quite a few engagements ongoing with DTI and EDD at NEDLAC around IPAP. also the understanding its effectiveness and so on, the gaps. So I think, Chair, we are really quite supportive of those departments and around IPAP. But I think, Chair, our frustration again is that we tend to leave it as a silo effect only on those departments, not other departments. And again, also, Chair, I think also our frustration is around the fragmentation of the state. After every election, we create new departments. So currently, we have separated agriculture from land reform. We really think we need to consolidate our departments. We're splitting them far too much, and it really creates a bit of fragmentation. And in fact, at times, you find that agriculture and land reform are both busy with bills dealing with the same issue. And it really creates a bit of a headless chicken difficulty. I think the last two members, Chair, around the court decisions. At times, Chair, we've got good policy as government, but they're not implemented. So you have a place in Kailisha, Chair, in Kanini, where I think you've got about 30 toilets for about 20,000 people, 30 or 300, one of those two figures, for about 20,000 people. It's hopelessly too little. But also there are too many informal areas kept on across the country where there are still today no basic services, despite the many progressive court judgments. I think last, Chair, Honourable Ted Blanche. Government has started this kind of private sector equivalent of the EPWP with the learnership programs and the employment tax incentives. And we sympathize with government trying to create jobs, protect jobs. Our frustration there is that around kind of it's so open. We feel that it's kind of actually adding a stimulus to casualization of permanent work. And for COSATU, many of the unions, the real frustration is around the issue of labor brokers. But yet we now have labor brokers being able to access taxes through employment tax incentives and so on, or through learnerships. That's really created a frustration. I think the other frustration we've had around that, those support for the private sector, is that there's been no kind of guarantees that those are for new jobs or for permanent jobs. So that's been kind of our bugbear around those two issues, Chair. I hope I haven't taken too long, but then I've answered the members' questions with the properly, Chair. Thanks very much.
No, thanks very much. Members are asking me to go for the second round. So let me go for the second round, which is the last. Honorable Dibier.
Mine is a short one, Chair. Matthew referred to RDP houses with electricity trucks. If he can give that specific to us, I've got the same situation in my constituency. It is the box outside on the pole. In terms of the voltage, you get different types of the feeding. And it depends on what type of box we put up at the pole outside. It's a practical thing, and it must be done by the electricians who are qualified. So if we can get the detail, then we can attend to this one.
Thank you, Honorable Pierre, Honorable Chopin.
Thank you, Chair. There is something that the presenter mentioned that I didn't hear properly. It was about maybe a researcher from the USA, what is it? I think it was about SAE, something like that.
Okay, those two areas, I think Matthew said something about the efficiency of state corporations, ability for them to fulfill their mandates without necessarily operating outside of their financial scope capacity. But you cautioned on the issue of unemployment at some point, that the danger to commercialize without attending to clearly the consequences of such actions. I think that fine balance, you're welcome to respond to the questions, I think, as members stated.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe just for Honorable De Beer, the specific area I was referring to, the area in Cape Town called West Bank,
That's Ward 19 in Cape Town. I'll write it down. In fact, I think what I can do, Chair, is that I can just ask our COSATU provinces to give us a list of all those informal areas, and then we can send it to the honourable members. But yeah, this specific area, the area called West Bank, and I was very ashamed to go canvassing there, won elections, and to get into the house and then to be scolded, and I had no answer, because they would just show me that here's a kettle, put the TV on, and off it goes. So yeah, that is the area where the water, because it's below the ground level, the water creeps in, and if you use more than one electrical appliance, it trips. I think there's probably many of those areas throughout the country, but what I think I can do to help, I'll just see if I can get a comprehensive list from our COSATU provinces, that we give it to the honourable chairs and to the members. Chair, yeah, in terms of the issue, it is the Bain Capital. It's a company in Boston in the United States. Colleagues might remember that in the 2008 elections in the U.S., the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, he made his fortune from this company, and it was quite a hot issue in the U.S. that Bain Capital was seen as, in the U.S., in their own politics, as vulture, that they take a company which is battling, they gut it, and then they sell it for a quick profit, and the ones who suffer are the workers who are then retrenched. And then they often find the managers making a killing by selling it. So we were a bit concerned when we saw that Treasury has appointed Bain Capital to do a study on SAA, Mango, SAA Airlink, or Express. And look, we support government. We must get a hold of the airline crisis. We can't deny that. We must do it. I would concern, Chair, that if you bring in Bain Capital, the only modus operandi is profit. Our fear, Chair, that we're going to find airline workers being retrenched. And SAA, Chair, even the previous years was planning to retrench about 700 workers. Chair, why we were mentioning that is that we feel there's a need for government to intervene in a timely way with those airlines, in a way, as you're saying, to consolidate without retrenchment, and to do it in a proper way. We think there are ways you can do it, but we also agree that, Chair, you can't expect government to forever and ever bail out the airlines. I think they spent about $5.6 billion this year and $4.5 billion the previous year, if memory serves me right. So our plea is to do it in a humane way, which will not cut workers' jobs. If jobs must be reduced, let it be through natural attrition rather, or at the top levels. I think, Chair, also on the SOEs, is that the Department of Public Enterprises was planning to bring the shareholder bill to Parliament for some time now, and we've not seen any movement in that regard. When you engage with the Department, it just seems to be stuck somewhere. I want to say that is going to help government to intervene properly around the SOEs, because at times you find they seem to view themselves as independent of government and not accounting to government around the developmental mandate you gave. But I think also, Chair, around the corporate governance. And we've seen a very bizarre scenario in Parliament where you have SABC with one person on the board kind of wanting to challenge Parliament's authority to intervene on governance issues there. So I think, Chair, that was a plea there. But I think also lastly, Chair, around this issue, that government has made a progressive commitment not to retrench workers. But you have SOEs who don't seem to feel also bound by that mandate, be it SAA, be it Telcom, be it Eskom, etc., and even the post office previously. And you find, Chair, there's a huge amount of labour brokers being used in the SOEs, and it's increasing all the time. Yet government made a very bold progressive commitment not to do that. So, yeah, Chair, I hope that assists with the members' questions. Thanks very much.
No, thanks very much, Matthew. We also appreciate your organization's submission to this process of formulating the budget. I think it provided very useful ideas that will be factored into both committee's reports. Will clearly consider areas of your submissions in our committee reports, which later the committee reports will be tabled in both houses of the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. And quite members are quite appreciate that the agency for our country to find the right formula for the growth of the economy and sacrifices between government, business, and labor is quite crucial to attend to the glaring needs of our people. So we all of us know that the budget should help us to address people's problems. So finding this balance is quite an important measure moving forward. So we appreciate it. And honorable members, the other submission I indicated earlier, public service accountability data, is noted for the committee considerations when you go into separate committee sessions, and the report obviously will flag what issues are raised in the committee so that we don't lose sight of all stakeholders that have made trouble to comment on the advertisement that we have put forward. And then the first session of our meeting will conclude joint meeting, and thanks very much, because now we'll take a break that allows the standing committee to proceed with the next meeting as scheduled, with their hearing on the Chief Justice, Office of the Chief Justice, on the 2016 Adjustment Appropriation Bill. So thanks very much. We can have comfort break for 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Honourable members, I'd like us to settle down so that we can start. Around the clock, you're on duty. So get used to that. 24 hours around the time. See, we are ready. Shall we start? I strongly believe that we need to get God's guidance for the work that He has put in our hands for His children. So I'm going to ask that we close our eyes and observe a moment of silence for prayer and meditation. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, a copy of the agenda was circulated. Just want to check if we all have, and if you don't have, can you please indicate by show of hand so that you can be provided with a copy. All right. It looks like we all have. Thank you very much. And I will then give opening remarks, and after that we'll get the apologies and then presentation by the Office of the Chief Justice, and then engage in deliberations and then close. Honourable members, our guests, ladies and gentlemen, or maybe I should say guests, the Office of the Chief Justice, guests, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you all to this very important public hearing, wherein we will receive submissions and inputs from our stakeholders. And actually, since this morning, we were receiving those submissions. And then the Office of the Chief Justice happened to be one of the stakeholders that we thought, you know, should also come and appear before us and make a submission. It is a submission on the 2016 medium-term budget policy statement, the adjustments appropriation bill, the finance bill, and also a briefing by, talking about Office of the Chief Justice on its 2016 budget adjustment. Parliament provides a national forum
for the public consideration of issues and facilitates the involvement of the public in the legislative process. We all know these are indeed challenging times for our economy, and all inputs are most welcome on how best to use the limited resources that we have. Now, your inputs and efforts are most valued and appreciated. But then we will then receive the briefing by the Office of the Chief Justice, and thereafter engage. And you can rest assured that in our engagement, that those issues that we want to look at and consider also in our report, that will be tabled to the House. We've selected few, we looked at few departments, and then we then thought, no, we should prioritize this very important office just to come and appear before us, and then we consider that in our report. Thank you very much for coming. Well, I do want us to adopt the approach that says this is our meeting, so I'm sure you are free now and relaxed, because I do want you to be free so that we can have a meaningful and constructive engagement. Are you okay? Are you okay? Thank you very much. All right. Shall we then move on to... Let's check the apologies from our side, from the committee. Are there any apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson. Morning to all the members. We have four apologies, one from Honourable Sheikh Imam, Honourable Sheikh, Honourable Madloba, and Honourable Ndongeni.
Okay. Thank you very much. These are the apologies. Do you accept the apologies, Honourable Member? Honourable Member Sheila. Any seconder? Honourable Member Nukwanya. Thank you very much. Shall we then proceed to... Maybe it will be appropriate that we introduce ourselves so that we know each other, and that will make us even more, to feel more at home with each other. Starting from me, I am Yvonne, commonly known as Pinky Posa. I'm the chairperson of the committee. And then this side.
My name is Sheila Shopesitole, well known to the Office of the Chief Justice.
Thank you very much.
From my previous life.
Oh, now we know you've had other previous lives. Okay, thank you very much, Honourable Member.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Doris Senokanyane, a member of this committee.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ndaba Qobaza, Whip of the Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Qobaza. Over to you, that side.
Good morning. My name is Alan McLaughlin. I'm a member of the committee.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
I'm Sibongile Manana, a member of this committee.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Shall we then come this side and start from... Let's see, yeah, that side.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Kasi Kutzer. I'm the Chief Financial Officer in the OCJ.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Mem Mese Josingwe, Secretary General, Office of the Chief Justice. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Tebogo Mashifane. I'm the Director of Administration and Parliamentary Support. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Itumele Malau. I'm the Director for Monitoring and Evaluation in the Office of the Chief Justice.
Okay. Thank you so much. Yeah, let me not extend this to... let's know who is here. This room over there. Okay, shall we start from this side?
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members and Guests. My name is Mapules Katani from the Parliamentary Budget Office.
Parliamentary Budget Office is here. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Musa Ramisa, a researcher to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and members. My name is Pelani Dlomo. I'm a researcher for the committee. Thanks.
Thank you. Over to you, sir.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Reverend Mark Larson. I'm from the Methodist Church.
Did you hear him? Not quite. Can you just raise your voice, sir?
My name is Reverend Mark Larson. I'm from the Methodist Church.
Okay. Thank you. Over that side.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Yolis Walandu. I provide communication support for the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. I'm Oksina Ishmael, PMG.
KP?
No, PMG, Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
PMG,
yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning, members. I'm Nomfo Sechaso, the committee assistant of this committee.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Darren Arons. I'm committee secretary for Standing Committee on Appropriations. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Agma Benner from the National Treasury, Public Finance.
National Treasury is here.
Good morning. My name is Trinesh Periachu from the Budget Office, National Treasury, Fiscal Policy Division.
Thank you.
Morning, I'm Mr. Sabine Ngobeni, also from National Treasury, Public Finance.
Public Finance. Thank you very much. Now that we know who is here, can we feel even more free now? Come again. Oof. Madam.
Sand Lehali, Committee Secretary.
Thank you very much. Thanks, ma'am. Shall we then proceed with our business of the day? We are now on item that reads presentation by Office of the Chief Justice. So over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. The presentation is on the screen. Thank you for the opportunity to also come and appear before you. The presentation outline, we will deal with the purpose, the mandate of the department, the vision, mission and values, our strategic goals, the overall performance of the department for the first and second quarter of our annual performance plan 16-17, the percentage distribution by level of achievement in the two quarters 16-17, indicators that are not achieved in our remedial actions, the reason for the A&E environments, the 6 months budget and expenditure for the vote, as well as for the direct charge, and then the conclusion. As already alluded to, Chairperson and honorable members, we are presenting the Office of the Chief Justice National Department 1670 A&E environment request in the 6 months for the financial, also the non-financial performance. With your permission, Chairperson, we know we were limited to 12 slides, but we thought maybe the background of the department is important, but if I should dispense with that, I'll get guidance from you. Otherwise, I'll proceed.
Remember, so what would make you comfortable? Proceed. You may proceed, ma'am.
Thank you very much. The mandate of the Department of the Office of the Chief Justice is to support the Chief Justice in executing the administrative as well as judicial powers and duties in his or the capacity of that office of the Chief Justice as the head of the judicial arm of the state, as well as the head of the Constitutional Court, as the Chief Justice wears two hats. The functions that have been determined for this department are to provide and coordinate legal administrative support to the Chief Justice and the Judiciary, to provide communication relationship management services, including intergovernmental international coordination, to develop courts administration policy, norms and standards, to support the development of judicial policy, norms and standards, to support the judicial functions of the Superior Courts in terms of the Superior Courts Act, to render administrative support to the Superior Courts, to support the Judicial Service Commission to execute its mandate, as the OCJ is the secretariat, to support the Judicial Education Institute in the execution of its mandate, as it is charged with a judicial, continuous judicial education of judicial officers, both judges and magistrates, to administer the Judges Remuneration Act and Condition of Employment Act, as well as the Superior, the 17th Constitution Amendment Act, as well as the Superior Court Act, which has conferred on the Chief Justice the responsibility over the administration of judicial functions of all courts, as well as the judge's president in each division has been assigned the responsibility to ensure coordination of judicial functions of all courts within each province. The South African Judicial, in terms of the South African Judicial Education Institute, the Chief Justice is the chairperson of the council of the institute, and which has been established for judicial education of all judicial officers, as already indicated. Some of the functions relating to this institute has been transferred from the Justice College that sits in the Department of Justice in the past. The JSC, Judicial Service Commission, the Chief Justice is still the chairperson also of the commission, responsible for recommending candidates for judicial appointments, and also relating, dealing with the complaints relating to judges and the management of the Code of Ethics. The remuneration, judges' remuneration and conditions of service, we also provide that service to the judges, a function that was transferred from the Department of Justice also. The public the Judicial Matters Amendment Act is also an act that we administer. It's an act that has changed the accounting officer arrangement between the Department of Justice and the Office of the Chief Justice post the transfer of the Superior Courts, which has normalized the transfer of the DG's accountability to the Secretary General in all matters relating to this legislation above. Public Finance Management Act, Public Service and its regulations are quite straightforward and applicable to this department as it is established in terms of the Public Service Act. The vision, mission, and values of the department. Our vision is a single, transformed, independent judicial system that guarantees access to justice for all. Our mission is to provide support to the judicial system and ensure effective and efficient court administration services. Values are respect and protection of the Constitution, honest integrity, openness, transparency, and professional excellence. We execute our mandate through three strategic goals. The first goal, efficient and effective administration of the OCJ that provides optimal support to the judiciary, relates to all the administrative support that this department has to provide, including governance issues and compliance in terms of the Public Service Act, PFMA, and related matters. The second goal, improved administrative and technical support to the judiciary. Here we are enabling the judiciary to deliver its constitutional mandate by providing them with administration, technical support, which include judicial training coordination, secretariat services to the JSC, to the council, and also administering the registrable interests in terms of the Judicial Code of Ethics and the administration of the remuneration aspects. The third strategic goal is to ensure administrative support to the superior courts. It is the function that relates to providing administrative and technical support to the efficiency and effectiveness of the courts that are in all the superior courts, from the Constitutional Court to all the High Court General Division and the High Court Specialized Divisions. Slide number 9, overall performance. We move to the first and second quarter annual performance report for the 16-17 financial year. Overall in the financial year, In the midterm, we had in quarter 1, 18 targets, in quarter 2, 20 targets, total in 38, and our achievement is 29 out of the 38 in quarter 1, out of 18 we achieved 14, in quarter 2 out of 20 we achieved 15, and in quarter, that is 29. What we did not achieve in quarter 1 is 4. And in quarter 2 is 5, which totals 9. The next slide is an expression, honorable members, of the numbers per quarter, quarter 1 and 2, which indicates the planned targets, the targets that were achieved, and the targets that were not achieved, as I've already indicated in the previous slide. The next slide is a percentage distribution by level of achievement for the first and second quarter of the 16-17 year. In quarter one, we achieved 78% of all our targets in the APP and 22 not achieved. In quarter two, 75% still achieved and 25% unachieved. In terms of the targets not achieved, the nine that we have referred to, slide number 12 indicates those targets in the first quarter. The four of them, which relate to the filling of fake vacancies, funded vacancies, and the remedial action relating there to all the four targets. The first, as I've indicated, vacant funded posts filled. Our annual target is 90%. The recruitment process is closely being monitored as part of our intervention to ensure that we achieve this target. In the second target relating to the internal and external audit findings addressed, the annual target is indicated and the remedial action is that we have, as a department, put in place certain mechanisms to ensure that we monitor closely our audit findings. And the operations committee, which is the committee of directors in the department, work with the unit heads to ensure that on a regular basis, action plans that have been put in place and management action plans are followed up, and we reduce that. And we have seen that in the benefits of that in the second quarter. Third targets relate to reported fraud cases investigated, a target of 100% throughout the year. We have achieved the first quarter and the second quarter. We were not achieved in the first quarter, the second quarter has been achieved. The forensic investigation continually tried to improve on the management of witnesses and to expedite the interview process timeously and the recruitment of forensic investigator. We are increasing capacity in this area because it is also one of the shared services that we have with the Department of Justice. The fourth target, warrants of release delivered within one day of being granted, 100% throughout the year. We have achieved in the 90% in this quarter, which is below 90%, 100%. And the intervention is that we will ensure that as soon as the warrants are issued, they will be faxed to the court immediately. In the second quarter, we have five that were not achieved. And you will realize that the first, the second, and the third are actually repeated in the first quarter. The first one being the funded vacant posts, which we have indicated that the recruitment process is being monitored. And maybe to also mention that as we increase more of the posts, the denominator in terms of the numbers changes, but we are tracking the process in that sense. The second tender process finalized, this is the MSP, the ICT strategy, relates to target number 2 and 3, where the tender process was to be finalized and the tender requirements developed and tender advertised. We had a delay in this area due to incapacity in the ICT environment, but we have now in place the chief director responsible for ICT to ensure that these matters are fast-tracked. But the tenders have been approved, though outside the quarter, and the RFI have been developed and issued. Target number 4, fraud cases investigated, the reason is still the same as in quarter 1, which we say we have approved now in quarter 2, the increase of the capacity for forensic investigation, for the unit to be able to increase their capacity to trace the witnesses and ensure that the investigations are done within the time frames. The last 100% warrant of release delivered within one day, also relevant in quarter one. The protocol has been developed that will address and ensure that, amongst other things, the transmission of the warrant release are done by email from the chief registrar to the registrar, also to the prison where the prisoners are kept. The next slide deals with the reason for the A&E environment. The OCJ is requesting approval for the increase of its composition of employees budget by 8.4 million from the 546.8 million budget ceiling to 555.261 million. The 8.5 million is funded from the savings that we realized in the capital expenditure due to implementation of some cost containment measures. The OCJ is in the process of filling key posts at the Superior Court and Head Office as part of its capacitation program. As honorable members would know, we are a new department, and this is our second year of the vote, having been transferred functions and resources from the Department of Justice baseline. The non-filling of key positions might also impact on service delivery at the Superior Court, which is where the core mandate of the department lies. The next slide, 15, deals with the continuation, sorry. The 8.5 shortfall in the personnel budget is due to the following, and these are the reasons why there was a shortfall, and then we have the 8.4 million request. The 1.5 million, which is 7.644 billion in cost of living increase, because the salary increase was projected at 5.5 as per the National Treasury guidelines when we did the planning, when we did the preparation of the 16-17 E&E. And the actual increase came higher than that, at 7%, and the shortfall had to be funded within the existing approved baselines. And the second reason is the filling of key posts for agent capacitation in the new department. In some instances, we have had to make offers of higher notches to be able to get key positions in place. Otherwise, we would have to go keep on re-advertising over and over to get the appointment at the starting notch as is normally done. And these posts were budgeted for on the first notch of the salary scale, and the estimated additional cost amounted to about 756,000. Slide 16 is a six-month budget and expenditure for vote. For the vote, as you would know, members, our budget composed of the voted funds as well as the judges' salaries, which is the national revenue fund. Programs. We have three programs in the budget. Administration, which is standard in the national departments generally. Program 2, judicial support and court administration. And program 3, judicial education and research. In terms of the program, the total budget was 161,173 for program 1. And the 6 month midterm budget projection was 73.180, and the actual expenditure was 77,344, which is an over expenditure of 4.164 at 6%. Program 2, which is where the core mandate lies, the cause that we support in the judiciary, the budget, total budget was 665,972. The midterm budget projection was 306,627, and the actual expenditure 299,914, which is an under expenditure of 671,182%. Program 3, judicial education and research, which is where judicial education as well as policy and the regulatory support lies. 37,845 was the budget. And the projection midterm was 17,600. Actual expenditure at 14,180, and the variance of 3.42 at 19% under expenditure. And the total 864,990, and the total budget at 6 months is 397,407, and against the actual expenditure of 391,438, with a difference of 596 at 2%. The economic classification. The compensation of employees, as already alluded to before, 546,861 was the budget, the projections 254,236, actual expenditure 263,831, and the shortfall of 9,595 at 4%. Goods and services, 291,152 was the budget, projections 128,878. Actual expenditure 102,121 with a variance of 26,756. Transfers and subsidies 2.588, and we projected 877,000. Actual expenditure 1.109, a variance of 234. Capital assets and purchases 25. 389 was the budget, 13416 was projected midterm. We spent 24377 million with a difference of 10960, 82%. And the totals, obviously, in terms of classification and the programs would tally. As already alluded to, honorable members, the reason for the expenditure, the overspending of program one related to the telephone bill for the superior court for the first 6 months that was paid to the DOJ, the contractual arrangement relating to the fact that the arrangement between the OCG and the DOJ was that since the contractual arrangements between the service provider and the court still runs before the transfer, the DOJ will provide a bill, will bill us, and then the OCG will pay. So the individual cost will be generalized to the respective cost in Program 2 during Q3, and this relates to all the superior costs. The second aspect is payment of e-filing system, 6.9 million from the IJS, which is budgeted for in the DOJ budget, and the department OCJ has submitted its claim to the Department of Justice, and we are expecting reimbursement in Q2. Underspending on Program 2 is due to also the bill, as I've already indicated, the bill for the cost paid under Program 2 to be generalized, affected as a result of cost containment measures. The funds have been reallocated to other priorities in the AE&E process, including the request for the 8.4 million increase of the COA that we referred to above. Underspending of Program 2-03 is due to the postponed training courses in Sajay. Yes, about 6 courses were postponed, and the cost thereof is the result of the underspending. The next slide, 18. Continuation, it is the economic classification, moving from the program expression of the finances of the E&E. Overspending as a result of a shortfall in the personnel budget due to the difference in salary adjustments that I have referred to before, and the shortfall that had to be funded within the existing baseline, and as well as the higher notches that I had referred to where we had to offer, especially at SMS level, the notches other than the starting notch which we use when we budget. Goods and services, the underspending is due to reclassification by the Accountant General in Treasury of the judge's vehicles from goods and services as it used to be in justice to finance leases in the capital budget. And the department has reallocated the budget to the finance lease accordingly in the budget adjustment process. Transfers and subsidies. The overspending relates to payment of leave gratuity and to the judges, as well as the termination of staff, administrative personnel, since April 2016, and this overspending had to be rectified during the adjustment process. Purchase of capital assets. The overspending is due to reclassification, as already alluded above, on the judges' vehicles from goods and services to finance leases, and the reallocation had to be dealt with during the adjustment process. May the CFO just take over from here. Okay. Oh, there's 2 slides. No, I can finish. That's fine. I wanted to drink water. 6 months budget, sorry, Chairperson. 6 months budget and expenditure on the direct charge. We were dealing with the vote. The judge's salaries of 920,057. Total budget, 6 months midterm projections, 460,028. And our actual budget that we have spent against projection is 464,999, and the variance of 4.971 at 1%. The economic classification thereof, compensation of employee constitute 864,991 as budget, projection at midterm 432,949, and actual expenditure of 427,852, with a variance of 464,2. Transfers and subsidies, these are salaries of judges, and transfers and subsidies, as already indicated, is gratuities that we pay to judges at different terms and on retirement. 55.066 budgeted, and projections was 27,234, actual expenditure of 37, which is an over expenditure, 9.613 at 35%. The total 920057 against expenditure projection of 460,000,028 and the actual expenditure of 464,999 at 4.971% over expenditure. Reasons for under over expenditure: the overspending on the direct charge is due to leave gratuities that we pay to judges. As I've already indicated, when a judge reaches certain years of service or upon retirement, they are entitled to be paid gratuities. And the National Treasury had approved a transfer of 30 million during the budget adjustment process from the Department of Justice to us as the OCG, so as to recover the over expenditure in this area. Honorable Chairperson and members, we appreciate the opportunity to present the report to you, and we thank you. We'll take questions.
Thank you so much for the insightful presentation. Honorable members, you've been listening to this detailed presentation. I want you to reflect on it and then engage or interrogate the presentation. Honorable Member Manana.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome this presentation. I have two questions. The first one is with regards to the vehement of 16.3% and the 9.1%, which is way more than 8% as prescribed by Section 43 of the Public Finance Management Act. Can they just give us details with regards to that? The other question is with regards to the telephone bills from courts. As they have indicated that it's a contributory factor with regards to underspending and over under expenditure and over expenditure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Member Manana. Any other question? Honorable Member Snukwanyane and then Honorable Member Shopestole. In that order.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I just would like to find out, and thank you for the presentation, to find out, I see here that you had a problem of higher notches than you had budgeted for. What actually was the reason why were people promoted to very senior positions, or was it just a percentage? I may not have got it quite correctly then. The next one is on slide 16, the 6 months budget projections. What actually informs these figures on the projections? Because I would have thought that the projections would be something like 50% of the total budget, I mean, of what those two quarters, because it's for 6 months. So maybe just to clarify why the figures are the way they are. Because then they reflect as if the variance is too high or too low if it's like this. So just for my understanding of what this actually means. And then on slide 18, I see that the issue of, or maybe it's just an oversight, under goods and services and purchase of capital assets, it's exactly the same content. This purchase of vehicles and then the lease finances under capital assets, but the same thing. It may be a mistake, but just if you can. Yeah, I think that is all I want to ask about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. And thank you, the Office of the Chief Justice, for the information given. I want to talk to page 12, number 2, on targets not achieved and remedial
measures, I see you have got 65% of audit findings, internal and external. You know, the reason why we called you is because you are a new department, and we want you to be able to manage your affairs in a way that is not similar to old departments who have got their own habits, and we would like you to stay out of those habits that we are not so happy with. So when I see 65% is this your achievement of addressing findings. You see, any institution, even if it's a spaza shop or a country, if it does not listen to the internal auditors to an extent that the external auditors come and find problems, when you do have internal auditors, my question is, do you think the internal controls are in good shape? Do you have risk controls? Is it possible for you one day to finish us with your A report? Actually, I would like you to finish us with a report of the internal auditors, and to advise you that it is urgent and very necessary to have got 100% achievement on that aspect, because the more you postpone it, you'll never be able to actually achieve a clean audit. It's going to be very difficult. You are still new, you can still deal with these issues and make sure that you have got a clean a governance situation going forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can also refer the delegation to slides 12 and 13. I found these a little puzzling. The heading is targets not achieved and remedial measures. Then you list 90% of funded vacant post filled. What was not achieved? Was it the 90% that wasn't achieved, or was 10% not achieved? 100% of reported fraud cases investigated. Was that your not achieved? In other words, you investigated nothing. I don't understand what you're telling us in the table, or whether there's a miscommunication somewhere, but it looks a little bit puzzling to me. And I'd like to find out, fraud cases, is this internal fraud cases within a department, or is this nationally fraud cases reported at police stations? And if so, why are we just reporting on fraud cases? Why not other cases as well? Or is this just internal? And then also, it says they investigated. What was the outcome? Have any of these come to fruition, or have you just started an investigation? Has that investigation become completed or not? 100% of warrants of release delivered within one day of the release granted. Once again, is that what was not achieved? You didn't get 100%. And if that's the case, what did you achieve? It seems a fairly simple thing to do, actually, to sign a release warrant and fax it off to a court. So I would imagine it should be achieved and very easily achievable. It's one of those kind of targets. Then if I can refer you, please, to slide 19, I think it is. Yes, we look at slide 19, budgets and expenditure on your direct charges. I would have liked to have seen a column there that shows us what percentage of your target you managed to achieve in each instance in terms of the expenditure. You know, it's wonderful to have 100% expenditure, but you've only achieved 2% of your target, because that happens in departments. we need to be able to see the correlation of your expenditure related to the achievement of whatever target is you're trying to achieve with that expenditure. So we need to know, if you spend 100 rand, do you achieve 100% of the target for that 100 rand, or do you fall short or you go over? Give us some idea, because you're coming here and you're trying to justify environments that are in excess of what is legally permitted. I haven't heard a cogent argument as to why you should be allowed to go over the 8% that the legislation allows. In one instance, you're asking for double that. 16% environment is a lot. And I don't see any real good sound argument for doing it. And yet, you're requesting it. I'd like to concur and reiterate the questions that my colleagues already asked about the why are we suddenly paying more money to the judges than we budgeted for. It says to leave gratuities paid to judges on slide 20. Didn't we budget for that in the beginning? Wasn't it part of what we budget for, the leave gratuities? Why was it sort of left out and then had to be attended to afterwards? I get very concerned about the fact when we, a lot of what we're wanting to now spend is in terms of paying people money again. Because we're always being accused, no matter whether we're members of parliament or judges or whatever, that we earn too much money. It seems that MPs are getting a 0% increase, but judges are getting 5.5%. Now, you need to convince me somehow as to why judges should be entitled to it and not members of parliament. But I'd like to hear you on that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for all the questions, and they were... Oh, Honourable Member Kwabasa.
Thank you, Chairperson. The on slide 12, let me just quickly... No, 30. On item 3, you're talking about a tender that was advertised. And I assume that you're saying there was a request for more information. Now, it's not clear what more information was requested on that particular tender. And as a result, the tender was not advertised. If you could clear that first part, what information was missing about the tender. But second thing to that, was the advertisement suspended or cancelled altogether? If it was suspended and it's still going to be processed, what are the cost implications thereof of the delayed process? I was also going to raise a similar question to what Honourable McLachlan was questioning in that same slide, because it seems to me that you are a bit contradicting yourself, that you need to correct the reporting, therefore, because at one level it does suggest that 90% was achieved and only 10% was not, but then you are clapping all of them together. And then on 4 and item 4 and 5, you're saying, we assume you're saying 100% assumed, I mean achieved, but then on your right-hand side, you're saying remedial action is being taken. So it's not quite clear. Why? What remedial action would you take if 100% of what you planned for was achieved? Unless you're saying you achieved 100%, but in the process, you noticed that there were certain shortfalls or limitations which you're suggesting need improvement. The the last one, Chairperson, is on slide 15, that last bullet on the filling of posts. One would assume that in an office like the office of the Chief Justice, you need to always look for skilled, experienced personnel, and therefore budget correctly. Why would you budget for a lower level and then find yourself being forced to change midway? So I think that needs to be corrected. Thanks.
Over to you, ma'am, for responses.
And afterwards, members will be afforded an opportunity to do follow-up questions.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I will start with the first question on the requirements, the 16.3 and the 9.1%, which is way before Section 43.2 of the PFMA. And whilst we acknowledge the fact, our submission to the committee is that, one, we are a new department, and the functions that we are managing were transferred from the Department of Justice with their baseline SEs. And as they were transferred in October 2014 with the baseline SEs, the 17th Constitution Amendment Act, as well as the Superior Courts Act, came into operation, and those were not costed nor funded in justice at the time when the transfer happens. And as the OCJ created to support the judiciary in executing their mandate, be it in judicial administration or through the courts, the judicial functions, we found ourselves in a situation where with a uncosted mandate, which we have to execute, we did not have sufficient funds. So we had been in interaction with Treasury, firstly to also fund the implementation of Superior Courts Act. Remember, the Superior Courts Act gives the Chief Justice and the Judges President extra responsibilities that they did not have when the function was run under justice, in terms of exercising of the responsibility over judicial norms and standards on all the judicial functions. That function we had as justice to prioritize, because in February 14, the Chief Justice already determined the norms and standards which had to be implemented and they were gazetted. Treasury managed to fund us only in the next 2 years, I think 17-18 and 18-19, but for 15-16, 16-17, we still remained unfunded. Therefore, it means we had to look within to be able to see how we utilize the funds that we have to make sure that we give that support. I'll give an example. A judge president in the High Court just has a secretary, and there is no other capacity around besides the registrar's office to be able to make sure that he or she does the responsibilities assigned by the superior court in terms of Section 8. So we had to appoint, for instance, statisticians to make sure that they assist them with the court performance, which are required by the norms and standards to be monitored and to be reported on. I'm just using that as one of the examples. Some of the high courts did not have chief registrars dedicated to support the judicial function, which we had to make sure that we put in place so that we don't compromise the judicial functions. So in a nutshell, I am just saying that also we inherited both the macro and micro organizational structure from justice as is, as per baseline. And we had to realign that in line with the new mandates and constructed the new department, which process we are still busy with. Therefore, it was imperative on us to begin to make that alignment within what we have in terms of the budget. So I'm trying to explain the exceeding of the 8%. Because we are a new department, not that it is excusable, but we just had to make do with what we have. The question relating to the notches and the perception that it might be that we don't do proper planning, at SMS level, there's a lot of, I think, even not SMS only, when we appoint or recruit registrars, which are within the OSD dispensation, which I think you all are aware of the challenges in that environment. The judges' presidents are unhappy with the level at which registrars are appointed because we are not able to attract experienced people who are able to do the work. So as a result, to make sure that we get people who have the level of experience to support them, we have to offer salaries which are not at the level of the entry. The same with the SMS members. As a new department, we have to make sure that we appoint in areas where the controls and compliance is very critical. And unfortunately, most of the time, the people that we have to appoint are not able to be appointed at the start level because they are experienced, etc., already above. Or else we have to keep on re-advertising if we want to stick to the appointment at the entry level. Those are the challenges that we are faced with as a new department, because we are trying to fill the capacity in areas where capacity is not in or it was not there before when we started in terms of that. The CFO will take some of the questions on the finances, then I'll continue. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. On the question on the clarity on the six-month projections, Honourable Member, your question was, what do we use to project the 6 months expenditure? And therefore, sometimes you will see there's a deviation in terms of projections. As a new department, we never had any baseline or history to project anything as on a history basis. So what we have done in the 16-17, the current financial year, we were operating at that stage when we had to submit our 6 months, our annual projections or monthly projections to National Treasury. We were only operating for 10 months at that stage. So we didn't really have any history. So what we have done is we looked at the expenditure of the current financial year, which was then 15-16, and we used that as the basis of expenditure projections for the next year. One of the reasons for the over and under spending then in terms of projections are, as we explained, the issue of the Justice telephone bill, which was a new contractual arrangement between us and the Department of Justice. Maybe I should quickly explain that one. That was also a question in terms of clarity on that issue. When the functions were transferred from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development to the Office of the Chief Justice, there are a number of contracts that were in the concluded in the Justice Department. One of them was with Telkom for all the telephone bills and telephone services at the courts, the superior courts. That contractual arrangement in terms of the service level agreement signed between the DG and the SG still remains, and the process there is that Justice will then pay for the bills and on a quarterly basis claim the funds back from the Office of the Chief Justice. We then pay from Program 1, the administration program in the department, and after the payment is transferred to Justice, we then journalize these costs to Program 2 to the individual cost, individual courts to distribute the court the cost. And therefore, that is the reason for the over and the underspending. That is almost the same explanation. The overspending in Program 1 is because we paid the cost from Program 1. The underspending in Program 2 is because the cost still needs to be journalized for that same issue to Program 2. The same on the seemingly duplication on this, the reason for over and underspending for goods and services and the capital purchases. The overspending, the underspending on goods and services is because we are no longer paying the fixed cost of a judge's vehicle. As previously under the goods and services, the transport cost was the item under goods and services where we paid for the fixed portion, the monthly cost of a judge's vehicle. After the reclassification of the SCOA codes by the Accountant General late in 2015-16 financial year, this now becomes a finance lease. The budget was already, the E&E was already submitted and approved when the reclassification happened. So now the cost of the judge's vehicle is reflected under capital assets, the purchase of capital assets as a finance lease. So the saving in goods and services is as a result of the expenditure, the over expenditure that we now incur in capital lease. So it's just a balancing act now. Therefore, we request the shifting of funds. You will notice that there's a 12.8%. Request for, or not request, the shifting of funds in Program 2. That is the goods and services portion that we need to shift now to capital lease within the same program to fund the judge's vehicles. think I've dealt with that one.
On the question through you, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, on the 65% of audits and why we set our target too low, instead of the 100% achievement, we acknowledge and accept and thank the member for the guidance. When we did the planning, we also debated whether we should set ourselves at 100% as a new department. Regard had to be had that running the second year or even the first year of the vote, there are legacy issues. When the functions were transferred, it was a going concern. We had to take over the findings that were existing at the time of transfer. And at that time, we were still also in the transition and also to understand, especially in the superior courts, what the issues are with regard to capacity, etc. It is for that reason that we felt, rather in this, when we start, we should not, when it comes to audit finding, put 100% because we are not sure even about our own capacity to be able to deal with some of these things because we are building a ship that is already sailing. And at the same time, as I said, there are legacy issues. So we did consider that, madam, and we are aware of the dynamic relating to under-targeting. We have put in place, the other question was whether we have controls in place and whether we have risk controls in place. I can confirm that we may not be there because in the 2015-16 financial year, we got an unqualified audit, which was our first and maiden year of running the $1.5 billion budget with all the legacy issues that we have and all the other plans that we're doing to build the capacity to manage some of these things. These are the internal audit and the Auditor General's audits. What we do as a department is that we have put in place mechanisms where we have an audit facilitation nationally in my office that monitors all the action plans that comes from the legacy as well as those that happen during the year. And we monitor that on a continuous basis to make sure that we do that. We also have the risk, we appointed the risk manager. We have the risk plan as well as all the frameworks that are in place. And the audit and risk committee also monitors us on this and we report to them on a quarterly basis on what progress we are making. So I can assure you that this house, that when it comes to the audit findings, we take it seriously. We are strictly monitored by the audit committee and the committee that and the team that we put in place to monitor this is doing well. We did not do well in quarter one. But in quarter two, we exceeded the target. We are at, I think, 86 or 83% of having reduced those. And each and every unit head has got a liaison person who makes sure that the management action plans are monitored. So we cannot guarantee that all the controls are in place. We are also still studying the situations in the course, bearing in mind that when the functions were transferred, the capacity issues also still needs to be attended to. And that is why if you look at our request on the 8.4, some of these things that we are doing is to capacitate the cost because we realize this is where we will be hit hard, especially when it comes to issues of assets, library books, and other aspects that we have learned from the legacy reports of the internal and external auditor on the audit findings. So we are addressing those. And these things are linked to our request for the increment as such. So the request for the COE is not only related to the judicial functions, it's also having had regard to areas of compliance where in the course there are weaknesses that we are addressing. So we are those and we keep on being monitored on the spot by the Audit and Risk Committee. The other question was... Okay. The slides 13 and 12... No, 12 and 15, the target. The other question was that the targets here are not clear in relation to the remedial and the achievements. In terms of the first, on slide 13, in terms of the first target that is not achieved, which is the funded vacant post, the 90% is the annual target. The target for the first and the second quarter was 20% and 40% respectively. And I think the same argument with regards to the audit findings find relevance here. Because we are building a new department, we are aware that the standard in national in DPSA is that at least 10% should be the threshold for your vacant funded post. But we are a new department, we don't have the capacity in all areas. So we have cascaded it to be cumulative, so that at least by the end of the 16-17 financial year, we are at 90. Then when we go to the next year, we will be able to have built capacity. So that argument also still relevant here. In the first, we did not achieve those in the first two quarters. As I've said, 90% is annual target. Quarter one was 20, quarter two was 40, which we did not achieve at 17 and 31 respectively. And we are working on that. And because we keep on ensuring that we create capacity in several at different areas, obviously the denominator related to the number of your funded posts keeps on fluctuating. In addition to attrition, when people resign, when people leave the service, it also increases that. We are managing that, and we will make sure that in terms of our action plan, we monitor the recruitment process and the filling of posts closely. The audit finding targets is 60 and 70 respectively. The annual target is 80%, so the 65% relates to target, I mean to quarter one, and 70 at quarter two. As I've already alluded to when I responded to Madam Shope's question, in the first quarter we did not achieve, but in the second quarter we did achieve at 86%. So we moved from 49% in quarter one to 86% in reduction of our audit and managing our audit findings. Fraud cases, the question was relating to why only fraud and not other cases. This is relating to forensic investigations, which must be done within 60 days. I've already indicated we are increasing the capacity in that area. It is one function which was also shared between Justice and the Department, which we have been co-managing together, but in view of making sure that we are able to manage these cases. And it is also an issue the audit committee has raised with us to ensure that we address the capacity in that area. We have approved that the capacity be increased. But the issue of the non-achievement relates to the witnesses when they have to be interviewed by the internal staff in relation to corruption and fraud cases internally. The fourth target relating to warrants of release is 100% is an annual target, and it's 100% throughout quarter 1, 2, 3, and 4. In the first quarter, we achieved the target. In the first two quarters, the first and the second quarters, we did not achieve the quarters, but as I've indicated, our performance on the warrants in quarter 1 was 85%, in the second quarter was 95%. It is a target which we agree is at 100% it should be achieved, but it was only one instance where the prison refused to receive a warrant through fax, and as a result it fell out of the target. What was the other one? The investigations are not criminal investigations, they are internal cases where we find people are misusing a vehicle here and, you know, internal fraud and corruption issues that we must manage in terms of the rules and the PSA reporting. This one. Okay, you can go ahead, Adam.
Honourable Chair, I will also address the question on the increase and the gratuity for judges. I think there's maybe a miscommunication here. The 5.5% salary increase that we alluded to in the presentation is on the voted funds for the officials. So there was the cost of living increase of officials, which Treasury allowed us a 5.5% budget increase for, and eventually the officials got a 7%. As the Honourable Member would know, the judges are also part of the group that gets a 0% increase for the as the members of Parliament moving forward in the next financial year. But the issue is on the overspending on the direct charge was not for salary increases of judges, it's the gratuities paid to judges. Now, in terms of the Remuneration and Conditions of Employment Act, judges are entitled to gratuities after completing certain terms of service. After 10 years, I'm not sure about, it's 10, 15 and 20 years of service, where they are entitled to a certain gratuity. Now, it's very difficult to plan for these payment of gratuities because although you know when each judge will reach a 10 or a 15 or a 20 year, they can also choose to take the gratuity at any stage after reaching that term. So what sometimes happens, a judge will reach a 10-year service level, then he will not take his or her gratuity, and then at any stage after that, between the 10 and the 5 years, they then request their gratuity to be paid out. So that is what normally happens, and then you don't plan for that. But the part that makes it easy for a department is because it's a direct charge that is funded from the National Revenue Fund. It is just an arrangement then, or a request from the department to the to National Treasury to either increase or decrease the direct charge on your budget to rectify and balance out these issues. That is why you will also see that National Treasury has already indicated a 30 million transfer from the Justice direct charge for magistrates to the OCJ for the direct charge for judges, because of the previous year's salary increase that the public office bearers got. I can't remember the percentage, but that normally you're also not allowed to plan and budget for that in your direct charges. Treasury carries over the baselines of the three-year MTIF. Normally they allow you no increase, and once the increase happens, they then adjust your direct charge accordingly in the adjustment budget process. So I just want to make sure that the honourable members understand that we didn't plan for a 5.5% salary increase for the judges, who are also public office bearers. They are under the same rules as the legislature.
To all the issues raised. Have they responded to all the issues that you raised?
Chair, I think there was one issue raised about the delayed tender process for the e-filing system, the court e-filing system, and the implications thereof. What has happened in the ICT unit has decided first, before they go on open tender, they wanted to test the market in terms of an off-the-shelf solution for the court e-filing system, which in essence is a document management process. They then had interactions with CITA, who is responsible for our government ICT issues, to determine whether there might be transversal contracts that are already approved by National Treasury. So the RFI, the request for information, was sent out to some of the transversal companies that are contracted to National Treasury to provide information on possible solutions on this court e-filing system. After the ICT unit then received the information from various companies, they then went out and compiled the terms of reference for an advertisement to be done through CITA to the transversal companies. Now, the delay in the process was as a result of all the companies that were requested to submit information for the ICT unit to be able to do a proper terms of reference for advertisement. But as we are sitting here now, the request for advertisement is already submitted. The terms of reference have been approved by the Bid Adjudication Committee and it's been submitted to CITA for advertisement to all the transversal contract companies. So it was a delay between the quarter two and three, but it wouldn't delay the project in terms of our KPI for the financial year. And there are no additional cost implications as a result of this delay, because we will still finalize the issue within the financial year.
Do you have follow-up questions? Honorable Member McLaughlin, Honorable Member Snukwanyana, I would also like to come in on the follow-up questions. Over to you, Honorable Member
McLaughlin. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to Ms. Sejusengwe for the explanation. If you told me that in the first place, I wouldn't have asked a question about being in your department and the hassles you've had. It made more sense to me that way. Thank you for that. I just have one concern. From what you've told us now, it appears you've so far then achieved 48% of your filling of vacant posts. You said 17% in the one quarter and 31% in the other, if I heard you correctly, which says to me 48% have been filled. But at the same time, you've spent 4.9 million rand more than you budgeted for compensation of employees. Unless it's different, maybe one is separate from the other, I'm not sure. It's not clear from the documentation. And I'm concerned that if you're overspending already in the first half year and you've only achieved 48% filling vacant posts, we're going to have a huge overspend by the end of the year if you were to fill the rest of the vacant posts. Can you just address me on that? It might just be that it's not clear from the paperwork quite how that's structured, but I just had a concern there that, you know, when it comes to budget, next year we're going to be looking at a huge amount of overspend on salaries and compensation of employees. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member Snukwanyane.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. It's not really a question. I just want to comment, also acknowledging the fact that it is very obvious that the department is still new, and of course there is a lot of work that you need to put into the department. One of the things that I just forgot when I was mentioning the issue of the 6 months projection was that if you look at slide number 19, that looks more like it, because you've sort of made it like 50%, but it's by way of just commenting, because it's different, because it influences your environment figures when you put it in a particular way. And then in terms of I didn't ask this one, but I had just made an observation about the 65% target. I think one of my colleagues, who I think it's the Honourable McLaughlin, who mentioned that, you know, your heading says target not achieved, and that can give a wrong message, that these are targets that you have not achieved. And that 65%, it has not been achieved, but from your explanation we can hear. But I just wanted to also add the fact that, you know, these are audit, if these are audit findings and you target 65%, it could be a problem that you are not taking them seriously, because you need to. But of course we had your explanation that you have all sorts of, but maybe for future just to also prioritize your targets. And when you put targets, it also helps us to see how much of those targets you actually achieved. Because if you just come with the interventions or remedial action without us seeing out of the 65%, I'll focus on the 65% because it's not 100%, that how much did you achieve? Did you achieve the 65 or did you achieve 30%? And I think that's just what I wanted to say. Thank you so much.
Okay, from my side, you see the commonalities between ourselves, the Chief Justice Office and this committee, is that we would want to see compliance with the legislation all the time. Now, in some areas, all right, Honorable Member Snukwanyana says, okay, it's understandable, you are new. Now, my angle would be, then a new broom should sweep clean. All right? We all know they say a new broom sweeps clean, all right? But where you have, on your financial performance, you have a vision, if I'm correct, or if your vision is to ensure effective and efficient court administration services. Now, I would want to know if the budget that is allocated to you, is helping you to make an impact in this area of work. Maybe your monitoring and evaluation can respond to that one. Now, if you have your planning, monitoring and evaluation unit, on a monthly basis, they're supposed to give you feedback on your work so that you do not miss out on your targets. Now, I know that these units have been there for time immemorial, but we do not seem to see their impact. If, whilst they're monitoring on a monthly basis, you still come here at the end of the financial year and we still talk to violation of the PFMA. Same applies to your internal control systems. You have your internal audit unit, you've got your audit committee.
Of course, you would then expect them to work hand in hand with the monitoring, but they also, on a monthly basis, are supposed to assist you and ensure that you achieve on your targets, but also you avoid deviation from the PFMA on a monthly basis. Now, we would like to know their effectiveness, because we would want to get a report that says they are effective and are working, assisting you to work effectively and efficiently with the limited budget that National Treasury has allocated to you. Now, somewhere it's true, everybody has touched on this one, but I also would like to touch on it. Where you, I think you pay salaries or give higher offers than budgeted for. Now, my argument to you is, you see, when you advertise, everybody who applies will have seen that the salary, unless if you say to me in your advert, you do not show, you're not transparent about your salaries at an entry point. They would have seen that. So what would make you then later on, after they've seen this and they still have shown interest, and then they come in and negotiate for higher packages? What would make that? To me, it's very wrong. It is wrong. I think it violates the principle, the budget principle of, it says, you should not spend money you don't have. Because in this case, you're spending money you don't have, and you're deviating from the PFMA. You don't have that money. So what makes you to negotiate outside your budget for personnel and actually take an action to? Now, we want you to avoid that, because I told you, there's something common between us. The compliance part, we want you to lead by example there. We shouldn't come call you here to talk to you having deviated from the law. I think that's not fair. That's why we said, hey, let's stop it from the, let's nip this thing in the bud. So as you go back, we expect you to correct, because to me it says, then in your decision making, in this particular case, there were emotions involved. Unfortunately, with money and the law, I'm told, you know better. You can't. You cannot be emotional. You act according to law. So that's one area I wanted you to assist us with. And then on all the funds, I guess, of course, we are more interested in value for money as well. This committee follows where the tax money goes. And departing from the understanding that money will be linked to the plan, the budget will be linked to the plan. Okay? And then we follow that. Now, we would want monitoring and evaluation unit to tell us if this money that is allocated, I'm talking about the limited resources that are allocated to this important office, is making an impact. Value for money, impact. We want to see the impact from the money that you... There's also this one, because remember, in your structure, you must look at everything holistically. Your transformation plan. Do you have a transformation plan? And what is the progress in the in its implementation, because we don't have to wait until there's pressure. We must respond to the expectation. Now the expectation is, since we are operating within this radical socio-economic transformation phase, you would then expect response also from this office in terms of transformation. The radical socio-economic transformation, the underlying transformation. Do you have this program, and what budget has been allocated, and what impact are you making on the transformation of the office? Yes, I think that would be all from me. So are the other, no, so we're fine. Okay, Honourable Member Shopes Tole.
Thank you very much. I think from my part, I also want to give you some encouragement, because I remember very well I served in Justice, and Justice was a department which was giving ministers headache. I remember when Honorable Minister Jeff got into that, he called the department heads and said, please, I don't want headache. I don't want heartache. Because all the ministers who were in Justice had that. So from my knowledge, the Department of Justice has always been having very bad reports all throughout. It was only this Director General who has just left that actually got it right. But she, because it was a legacy issue, she could not just get it 100%. So I want to say I am impressed that you came from that difficult department with its legacy problems, but you managed to get a good report. So I just want you to keep fighting and keep it up until ministers love to be ministers of that department, because no minister actually wanted to be a minister of justice.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One small one. Over and under expenditure, which is prescribed. The acceptable over and under are prescribed by the PFMA. 3%, which is acceptable. Over and under, it's acceptable. But above that is an offense. Now I'm speaking your language. Now how can you commit offense? You see, I'm trying to make it look in a manner that will make you not to commit offense, because people expect you to lead by example in this area of complying with the law. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I always echo the sentiments that you are expressing, Chairperson and Madam Shope, to my team, that unlike any other national department, we carry the burden because we support the guardians of the rule of law. So we cannot be seen to be the ones who are not seen to making efforts to make sure that we steer clear of that. So I just want to give you comfort that that consciousness is there within us, and we do try our best to make sure that we don't. Because
just want action.
Yes. We will try to do that. I've noted the comment from the Honourable Member who just left here on the comments that he has made and the manner we expressed, and we will look at that, and thanks for that. Chairperson, you asked the question whether the budget that we are given versus the mandate is sufficient, and maybe before the M&E comments. Is that it is very difficult for us as a
is running a ship, building a ship that is already running at the same time. It's a difficult task because we have never been convinced that the budget that we have is sufficient to cover the mandate that we have been given. Even for the fact that we only run the superior courts and the other courts are still left outside. It is my view that I do not think the courts have always been sufficiently resourced to be able to do what it's supposed to be doing. And I think that is well documented. So what we do as the department, as a new department, we do the best that we can to make sure that with the funds that we have, we manage to focus on the areas that could head us west. I will give an example. In our MNE, Madam Chair, we have two. There's only two staff members. And who given where we are as a department, that does the best that they can to make sure that our monitoring and evaluation is up to scratch as we interact with the DPMEs and the other relevant department that we do. We do have a system in place and mechanism in place for monthly reporting where we monitor ourselves, both at national level, in the courts and the regions, to see how far are we steering away or closer to our targets in terms of achievement. Actually, my office does also play a role to coordinate that. Whether the internal controls are sufficient, I've talked to the area relating to forensic investigation target and the capacity issues that are raised. We are building capacity in that area. I cannot guarantee that we have sufficient capacity at this stage. We are still building it. And MNE may comment on that. And the effectiveness of the controls in the department, we have a risk management established to ensure that we have risk champions even in the courts. We have taken them through for training to make sure that in each division of the High Court we have a champion that makes sure that the internal operational risk that is in place is monitored and the risks are managed. In a nutshell, Madam Chair, the budget that the OCJ has to run its mandate is not sufficient. The internal controls, we are building those as we move along. And as I've said, in risk management, I've got two people. In internal, MNE, I've got two people. We are trying to increase that because each high court has its own dynamics in terms of issues, in terms of administration that we address. So it is not sufficient, but I think we do, as the EXCO and the OSCO in the department, address and make sure that we create also the capacity for those that are there to make sure that the staff are conscientized about issues of compliance. There are various issues that also impact, because serving the judiciary is not easy. I'll make an example with library book. A library book is moving because it's either in the library, in the judge's chamber, or is at home because the judge had to work late, etc., etc. So some of the things are legacy issues that we have had to do to make sure that we create a culture to say to judges, help us to make sure that some of the things, when the internal auditor hits us and wants this library book, we can account for where it is at. And I don't want to steer too much into the issues, but all I'm saying is that part of what we do is to create also a different culture, one of understanding by the staff of what are the issues that are going to cause us problems, two, conscientizing the judiciary to understand those issues that they might not be aware of that contributes to us being in the pit light. So it is a difficult task that we are holding and handling it far through. For an example, we even invited the chairperson of the audit committee as part of him understanding the challenges that in the environment that we operate in. He has also visited and met with the committee of judges on some of the issues that we have raised, just so that from all angles we create that consciousness that some of the things that staff or could be done within the court environment can cost us dearly at the end of the year if we don't manage them properly. The CFO can take the next question.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I would quickly just maybe respond to the question on the 48% filling of vacancies and the over-expenditure at this stage. Just to put the committee at ease, the overspending of the $9.5 million on our projections on the first 6 months was basically as a result of the salary increase, as we explained, the 1.5% that we had to fund, the back pay that we needed to pay as a once-off. That was from January, so it covered 3 months of the previous financial year, which wasn't part of the plan, and it also covered the increase in the housing allowance that was allocated or approved by National BPME, Public Service and Administration, only in this beginning of this financial year. So that was a once-off payment that caused, because we have a limited budget, actually we call it the photocopy budget of the Department of Justice when we got the transfer. And I want to link this, honourable members, I just want to give the assurance that the 8.4 million that we are requesting for the ceiling increase of COE is because on a monthly basis we monitor the expenditure on this, and that is where we determine that we might overspend this, and we don't want to overspend, and we want to comply. So we are monitoring on a month-to-month basis, and there will be no overspending if we get this allocation. Now, I also want to link this now to the Chair, to your comment, Honourable Chair, on the new broom that should sweep clean. We 100% agree with the statement. The issue is, because we got a photocopy budget of justice in 2015-16, Treasury didn't allow us any deviation. They said, let's do the going concern transfer. You get a photocopy budget from the Justice Department for each and every court, and from there you start with your capacitation, your new organizational structure, your macro and micro structure, and then capacitating from then onwards. So in terms of our relationship with National Treasury, it's going to be a 3 to 5 year process for us to restructure the budget correctly. That is also one of the reasons why Treasury didn't even indicate a problem with our request on the environment at this stage, because they know that the budget wasn't correctly structured when we started this as a new department. The budget that we're going to submit now, the E&E budget that we're submitting now for the next year, next financial year, will be correctly structured in terms of our own strat plan and APPs. We've also now agreed and we've got an approved new budget program structure for the first time now. We had our own input in the budget program structure, which was now approved by National Treasury. So our 17-18 budget, honourable members, we can give the commitment there will be no vironment exceeding 8% as we have this year, because for the first time it will be our own and real plan as a new department that we submitted.
Thank you very much. I see I'm not going to leave an officer off the hook. Monitoring unit. What is your role and what impact are you also making on the department so that the department can make an impact on its vision?
Honourable Chair, thanks. What we do on a regular basis is basically to support management with regard to the deliverables that they have planned. And on quarterly and monthly basis, we basically monitor and evaluate, you know, all the programs and produce a report that is tabled before the executive committee of the OCJ, and is interrogated at a particular level, and after that interrogation, that report is submitted, you know, to the ARC and to all other oversight structures. But what is more important is that, you know, from the deliberations that we have with management, we draw action plans, you know, on what needs to be done basically to correct, you know, the past performance. And then in the coming quarter, what will happen is that management will submit also their corrective action and also the progress made with regard to those plans. So this basically the controls that we have put in place basically to ensure that management actually takes, you know, the issue of performance very seriously.
And with regard to the impact, Honorable Chair, I think it is from our side, I think, given the newness of the department, it's important to mention that, you know, we are still currently building systems and also, you know, trying to build controls within the department. And as a result of that, we're insisting to have basically to conduct evaluation studies in the period of 3 to 4 years so that we can have constructive analysis. But given the newness of the department now, it's still difficult actually to come up with impact, you know, on evaluations because we are still building data and baseline basically so that over 3 to 4 years then we can have a constructive analysis.
I'm trying to check on what would be your recourse if after recommending certain action to as a corrective measure that is not done, what would be your recourse?
Honorable Chair, basically, as you may know, the functions of MNE basically is mainly to recommend, you know, so we cannot enforce. So basically, our report that we produce to the accounting officer. And then the accounting officer then will interrogate the report, and thereof, then she will come up with corrective actions thereof. And then also the ERC and, you know, other structures that are within the department.
Okay, I guess the Secretary General is the one who has to ensure that there is implementation. So make sure that there is implementation. Okay. All right, I think we've exhausted all the questions. And that being the fact, I would then request the Secretary General. Sorry. I thought maybe you had something to add. That's fine. All right, I was then going to say I request the office of the Secretary General just to give us your closing remarks. And there, that will be followed by my closing remarks.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. From my side, as the accounting officer for the department, I must appreciate the opportunity to be brought here early in the stage of running the department. As I've said, we are on the second, this is our second year of the vote, and we have the difficult task of supporting the judicial branch, which has its own dynamics and challenges, which we are grappling with. We appreciate the robustness and the issues that you have raised with us, because it raises also our consciousness to make sure that from this committee as well as our portfolio committee, the issues that are going to put the department in a bad light are identified early and raised with us so strongly as they were for us to be able to attend to them. But I would like to assure you, Chairperson and Honourable Members, that I'm supported by a team that, in my view, does the best that we could under the circumstances with the challenges that we have in terms of capacity. We have our own legacy issues. We don't want to blame justice for anything. It's a going concern. We own those challenges and we have to grapple with them. But resources remains a challenge. Resources remains a challenge for the department, especially that having the functions and the baseline being transferred as is, and the expanded mandates that comes from the 17th Constitution Amendment and the Superior Courts Act as implemented and having to support the judicial function is an area that we are grappling with, which we would like the committee also to assist us in the manner, in the way that they could, to make sure that we are able to do that. We are also, as the department, conscious of the compliance issues. We do interact with the Treasury, DPSA, and all the DPME and other relevant departments in areas where we need their support, and they do that. We have the Audit and Risk Committee in place, which has been running with us for the last 3 years, and which also keeps us on our toes to make sure that these things are managed and they work us very hard. It is not easy.
So I would like to assure you that we do the best we can. For the first financial year, made in year 15-16, we achieved 74% of our targets. We got an unqualified audit with findings, of course, and we had a new accommodation for the judiciary acquired. And we also managed to spend over 90% of our budget in the first year. And the issues that you are raising are very serious, and we take them in that light, and we will, going back, ensure that we share with the Expo and the management to make sure that we avoid all the risks that have been identified in this meeting. We would like to thank you for keeping us on our toes, too. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, honorable members. I would like to thank the Office of the Chief Justice for coming, and the National Treasury for always showing interest in our work, and all other key stakeholders present here. Thank you very much for coming, and I attribute the success of this meeting to your attendance. Okay. I would like to thank you for your full participation in this critical briefing from the Office of the Chief Justice. On its 2016 budget adjustments, it is clear that the committee acknowledges that you are still a new department, but members are concerned about internal controls, setting smart targets, because if you set those targets, they must be implementable. It is you who set the targets. Therefore, they must be achieved. Members are concerned about compliance with laws and regulations, your PFMA, your National Treasury regulations. Members are concerned about value for money. We want to see value for money. That's our way. Because this is not our money, it is the taxpayer's money. The taxpayer must benefit from his or her money. Concerned about spending efficiencies, monitoring mechanisms and planning. We know that a key focus area for the Office of the Chief Justice is on improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the court system. That's your vision. You set this yourself. After carefully applying your mind, this is what you agreed upon as a vision that will be pulling you into the future. Okay? And honorable members support this priority. We welcome the commitment for better budget implementation in 2017. We also welcome the commitment to, I'm sure you listen carefully to this one, to moving to the office to greater heights by obtaining a clean audit, looking at your face and listening to your interventions. You can do it. So next day we'll be calling you to hear if you have achieved on this one. See? We trust you with this one. And also your commitment to doing more with less. It's a budget principle. And staying within your budget allocation, regardless. You've got to be very strict. You've got to be intolerant to any, you know, deviations. Staying within and continue to give this office the integrity with which it is carrying itself. It is an office that commands respect, and indeed we all respect it. So let's not put it into disrepute by allowing it to deviate or violate the same laws that it is expected to work within. All of us in this committee have got to work within the parameters of the law, regardless. And we've learned from this officer there's no one is above the law. So we have to work within the parameters of the law. We wish to note that and welcome the fact that Limpopo has become the 8th province to have a seat of a high court. We must congratulate you on this achievement. It's a great achievement. Well, the Mpumalanga seat of the High Court is earmarked for completion in 2017. We're very excited with that very end. Now, the Limpopo High Court meant that millions of people would no longer have to endure the cost of commuting to Pretoria for High Court services. So thanks, our greatest thanks to the Ministry and to the Office of the Chief Justice. Please convey our congratulations to the Chief Justice. We will include the discussions from today in our report and wish to thank the Honourable Members, the Office of the Chief Justice and all staff and guests for coming. And thank you very much. This then, I think, ends our... Okay. Thank you very much. The meeting between ourselves then adjourned. And then, just as a reminder to the honourable members, on Monday,